It is 11 at night. The kitchen light is too bright. You went to make one more cup of coffee, the cup that justifies staying up, and the box is empty. No filters. So you do the thing a person does now. You pick up a glass rectangle, and you type, almost word for word, "It is 11 p.m., I'm out of coffee filters. What can I use instead?" And a few hundred milliseconds later, a machine that has never been in your kitchen, never smelled coffee, never run out of anything, tells you to try a paper towel, or a clean cloth, or a fine metal sieve. That tiny, ordinary moment is the entire subject of this series.
Okay, but I want to flag something right away. That feels almost too small to be interesting. It's a question with a known answer. Why not just look it up?
Because look it up is the wrong model of what happened. And it's worth being blunt about that up front. Confidence? Very high. A search engine matches your words against documents somebody already wrote. If no human ever sat down and wrote a tidy little article titled, "What to Do When You Run Out of Coffee Filters," a pure lookup has nothing to hand you. The machine you just used didn't retrieve a sentence, it composed one.
And that distinction is the whole ballgame, so let me make it concrete. I'm going to keep coming back to those exact words. It is 11 p.m., I'm out of coffee filters. What can I use instead? For 5 hours, so let's look at what they actually demand. First, the machine has to register that filters here means coffee filters, specifically. Not aquarium filters, not Instagram filters, not a sort operation in your code. The word is the same, the meaning is pinned by its neighbors.
Right. Coffee sitting next to it does the pinning.
Exactly. Second, it has to understand the request is about substitution. That little word, instead, is doing enormous work. It's telling the machine, I don't want to know what a coffee filter is. I want to know what could stand in for one. And third, it has to know enough about the physical world that a paper towel is porous, holds back grounds, lets liquid through, and a steel sieve sort of works, and a sock would work, but is gross. None of that is in the sentence. The sentence is 11 or 12 words. The answer draws on things the words only gesture at.
Stop. Let us be precise about the verb answer, because we will use it for 5 hours, and it should mean one exact thing. The machine does not answer in the sense of knowing a fact and reporting it. Here is the actual operation. Given the sequence of words so far, it produces, one position at a time, the next word that best continues the text. That is the entire mechanism. Everything that looks like understanding is a consequence of doing that one thing extremely well.
Wait, that's it? The whole thing is just guess the next word? That can't be enough to suggest a paper towel.
It sounds insufficient. It isn't. That's the part people refuse to believe, and it's the part that turns out to be true. Predict the next word, done across a staggering amount of text, forces the machine to internalize grammar, world facts, and the relationships between things, because you cannot reliably predict the next word without them. The simplicity of the goal is hiding the difficulty of meeting it.
Let me give you the version that made it click for me. Take our specimen. It is 11 p.m. I'm out of coffee filters. What can I use instead? And now let it run on a little past where you actually stop typing. Not a restatement, a deliberate continuation, the machine's own draft of where the text is heading. So I'll just use a, and now it has to pick the next word. To put high odds on paper towel and low odds on stapler, it has to have absorbed something about what coffee filters do and what objects share that function. The prediction task is the pressure. Meaning is what gets squeezed out under that pressure.
And hold on to that, because the scale is the thing that turns a parlor trick into a phenomenon. The pressure isn't applied once. It's applied across hundreds of billions, trillions of words. Books, manuals, arguments, recipes, code, the whole sprawling transcript of people writing things down. Trillions of tiny, what comes next, guesses, each one nudging the machine to be a little less wrong. That accumulated nudging is where the apparent competence comes from.
So, there are kind of two different stories here. There's what happens right now, tonight, when I send the sentence and get an answer back, and there's whatever long history made the machine capable of that in the first place.
Yes, two passes. Name them clearly now, because we will keep them strictly separate. The first pass is what happens at the moment you ask. The sentence goes in, computation runs forward through a fixed machine, an answer comes out. The machine does not change. We will call that inference.
The second pass is how the machine got good in the first place. The long, expensive process of adjusting the machine itself, word by word, against all that text, until its guesses stopped being garbage. We will call that training. And the crucial thing, tonight's coffee filter question is pure inference. The machine that answers you is frozen. Nothing it does for you changes it one bit.
Which is why the first part of this series only deals with inference. We take the machine as already trained, already frozen, and we follow your exact words through it, step by step, until a suggestion falls out the other end. Training. How the freezing got the right values baked in, we hold off on until part two. Two passes, two halves of the series. Don't mix them.
Okay, that ordering actually makes sense. Watch the finished instrument get played first, then go back and learn how it was tuned.
A good way to put it. And the instrument metaphor is going to earn its keep later, when the signal really starts flowing.
So here's the contract for where we go next. Right now your sentence is just words, symbols, characters on a screen. The machine cannot do arithmetic on the word coffee. So the very first thing that has to happen before any of this clever next word prediction can begin is that each word, each token, since you already know how the text gets chopped into tokens, has to become numbers. Specifically, each token becomes a long list of numbers, a point the machine can actually compute with.
And I'm guessing the way those numbers get chosen is not arbitrary.
Not even slightly. The numbers are positioned so that coffee and filters land near each other, and 11 p.m. lands somewhere else entirely. And that geometry is what lets the machine treat related things as related. That's exactly where we start next.
Words in, numbers out. That's the doorway. Everything else is on the other side of it.
So keep the sentence in your ear, exactly as you typed it. It is 11 p.m. I'm out of coffee filters. What can I use instead? We are about to watch those words stop being words. We left your sentence in a strange, in-between state. The words have been chopped into tokens. You already knew how that part goes. And we'd promise that each token has to become numbers before the machine can do anything at all with it. So picture the token for coffee sitting there, waiting. Right now it is nothing but a label, an entry in a list. And the whole job of this segment is to turn that label into a place, a point the machine can actually compute with.
But hold on, after tokenization, doesn't each token already have a number? I thought every token gets an integer ID. Coffee is what? Token 41,000 something. Isn't that already a number?
It is a number, and that's exactly the trap. It's a number the way a parking spot number is a number. Spot 41,000 isn't bigger or better than spot 40,999. It's just a name that happens to be spelled with digits. The token ID for coffee and the token ID for filters could be wildly far apart as integers or accidentally adjacent, and neither fact would tell you anything about coffee or filters.
Right. The id is arbitrary. If you try to do arithmetic on it, average two ids, subtract them, you'd get garbage. Token id plus token id is meaningless. That's not a deep claim, it's just true. The numbering came out of a tokenizer's bookkeeping, not out of anything about the world.
Okay, so the id is a coat check ticket, not a measurement.
That's the right instinct. And a coat check ticket is useful for exactly one thing, looking something up. So that's the first move. The id is an index. You take it to a big table and you read off a row. That table is the embedding table. Think of it as one row per token in the whole vocabulary. And every row is a list of numbers of the same length.
Let me pin the object before it drifts. The thing you read out of that table is called an embedding vector. Definition. The continuous, high-dimensional numeric vector the model assigns to a token. It replaces the discrete token id with a position in a learned space. Not a word vector, not an encoding. Embedding vector. And the space those vectors live in is the embedding space.
Continuous meaning real numbers? Decimals, not just integers?
Continuous meaning real-valued. Each slot in the vector is a number like 0.31, or -1.8. Not a label, a coordinate.
And here's the load-bearing word for the rest of the series. The length of that list, how many numbers are in every embedding vector, is fixed for a given model. We call it the model dimension. I'll write it, when I have to, as a single letter D, but I'll say the model dimension out loud so it doesn't get lost. For a real model, it's big. 1,000, 4,000, sometimes more. So coffee doesn't become one number. It becomes 4,000 numbers all at once that together name one point.
4,000 numbers for one word? That feels absurdly extravagant.
It's the opposite of extravagant, actually. One number gives you a line. Everything has to be ordered, more or less, on a single axis. Two numbers give you a plane. 4,000 numbers give you 4,000 independent directions to spread meaning out in. You need that room, because coffee is similar to tea in one way, similar to morning in another, similar to filters in a third, and those similarities don't all live on the same axis. High dimension is how you avoid forcing unrelated similarities to collide.
Let me give you the handle I'm going to lean on, because you'll feel it immediately. Think of a synthesizer patch. You've got, say, a few thousand knobs and sliders, cutoff, resonance, envelope times, oscillator mix, the lot. Any single setting of all of those knobs at once is one patch, one sound. Now, the embedding vector for a token is exactly that, a full setting of the model dimensions worth of knobs. Coffee is one patch. Filters is another patch. The ID was just the preset number you punched in. The embedding vector is the actual knob positions that preset recalls.
Oh, so two tokens being similar means their patches are set close to each other? Most of the knobs in nearly the same place?
That's it, and that's the payoff, because now close means something. Coffee and filters end up as nearby points. Most of their coordinates land in similar spots, because they show up in similar company. They belong to the same little corner of the world, whereas 11 p.m. lands somewhere else entirely, often a region that's doing time of day, late night, clockish work. Same space, very different neighborhood.
And state precisely what nearby buys you, or it's just poetry. It buys this. Geometric closeness in the embedding space stands in for learned similarity. When two tokens sit near each other, every later operation that reads their vectors will treat them as related, automatically, without anyone writing a rule that says coffee relates to filters. The geometry carries the relationship.
I want to draw a hard line here, because this is where people start hallucinating. The lookup table is real mechanism. The fact that coffee reads out a specific list of numbers, concrete in the weights, you could print it. The fact that similar tokens land near each other, that's also real. You can measure the distances. But the tempting next step, oh, knob 400 is the caffeine knob. Knob 900 is the time of day knob. That is mostly a useful model, not the truth. The axes are not cleanly labeled. Meaning is smeared across many directions at once. So, positions, real. Neat human names on each axis, mostly a story we tell.
Wait, so where do the actual numbers come from? Who decided coffee sits next to filters?
Nobody decided. That's the beautiful part. And it's a promissory note for part two of the series. At the start, that whole table is random. Every token is a random patch. Everything's scattered. No neighborhoods at all. The positions get pushed around during training by the same next word prediction pressure we talked about. Tokens that keep needing to behave alike get nudged together. Tokens that don't drift apart. By the end, the geometry has organized itself. We're taking that finished frozen table as a given right now. We're running the train machine. But I want you to know the arrangement was earned, not designed.
So back to my first question, why not just keep the integer ID and let the machine learn what to do with it directly?
Because you can't smoothly nudge an integer index toward a better one. 41,001 isn't a little bit more coffee than 41,000. The ID has no slope to it. But a list of real numbers, you can push any coordinate a hair in either direction, and the meaning shifts a hair with it. That smoothness is what lets the position be tuned at all. Continuous numbers can be adjusted by tiny amounts. An arbitrary index can't.
Short version, you trade a name for a location, Because you can do math on locations, and you can't do math on names. That's the entire reason.
So look at what we've actually done to your sentence. Coffee. Filters. Instead. 11 p.m. Each one has stopped being a label in a list and become a point in a vast space, thousands of directions wide. A patch. A position. And the positions aren't random. Coffee and filters are practically neighbors. 11 p.m. is across town. The machine can finally compute because it's finally holding something with geometry.
But all of these points are just sitting there, independent. The vector for coffee doesn't know filters came right after it. Order isn't in here yet, is it?
No, it isn't. Right now, coffee filters and filters coffee would hand you the very same 2 points, just 2 patches in a bag, with nothing saying which came first.
And word order is not a detail you get to skip. So that's the next thing we have to fix. How you stamp position onto a point that, so far, knows nothing about where it stands. Here is a small thing that should bother you. Take the 2 words, coffee and filters. Put them in that order. Coffee, then filters. And you have a thing you keep in a drawer, a little pleated paper disc. Now flip them. Filters, then coffee. Suddenly, filters is a verb, and you have a machine straining grounds into a pot. Same 2 words, same 2 points in space. The only thing that changed was the order. And so far, in our machine, the order is the one thing that has gone completely unrecorded.
Right, and we left ourselves exactly this cliffhanger last time. Each token became an embedding vector, a list of D numbers, D being the model dimension, the fixed width of every vector. Coffee got its position in embedding space, filters got its position. But the lookup that produced those vectors only ever saw the token, never where the token sat in the sentence. The embedding for filters is the same whether filters is the second word or the fifth word or the last word.
Wait, but I handed the machine the words in order. They came in as a sequence. Doesn't that just carry through?
That's the trap, and it's a good instinct, so let me show you why it doesn't. Think about what we actually have after the embedding step. We have a collection of vectors, one for each token. And the operation that comes next, the one we'll build over the following sections, does not walk the tokens left to right. It treats them as a set, a bag. Every token gets to look at every other token all at once. And nothing in that machinery says, this one came earlier.
Let me make that precise, because it carries through is exactly the kind of hope that hides a bug. The next operation is symmetric in its inputs. If you took the bag of vectors for coffee filters and the bag of vectors for filters coffee, those 2 bags contain the same 2 vectors. As unordered sets, they are identical. A function that can't tell 2 identical sets apart cannot possibly give you 2 different answers. So the meaning difference, drawer object versus straining machine, is, at this point, mathematically invisible.
So the bag of embeddings literally cannot know which came first. It's not that it's bad at it, it can't.
Correct. And I'm at essentially 100% on this one. This isn't a modeling subtlety, it's a hard property of the operation. Order information is not weak in there, it is absent. If you want the machine to behave differently for coffee filters than for filters coffee, you have to put the order in by hand. Nobody gets it for free.
So that's the job. We need to stamp each token with where it stands. And here's the clean idea the transformer uses. We already have, for every token, a vector of length D sitting in embedding space. We're going to make a second vector, also of length D, one that encodes nothing about which word it is, only its position. Position 1 gets 1 such vector. Position 2 gets a different one. Position 3, different again. And then we just add them together.
Add them? Add the position vector onto the word vector? Coordinate by coordinate?
Coordinate by coordinate. Same length, so it lines up. The first number of the position vector adds onto the first number of the embedding, the second onto the second, all the way down all D coordinates. What comes out is 1 vector, still of length D, that now carries both facts at once, what the token is and where it sits.
Name it so we can keep it straight. The vector we add is the positional encoding. The thing the model actually works with from here on is the sum, embedding plus positional encoding. 1 combined vector per token. Say it that way every time, combined vector, so you never confuse the raw lookup with the position stamped result.
And now run our 2 cases through it. coffee at position 1, filters at position 2. The coffee vector gets the position 1 stamp added on. The filters vector gets the position 2 stamp. Now flip the sentence. Filters at position 1, it gets the position 1 stamp. Coffee at position 2, it gets the position 2 stamp. The word vectors are the same as before, but the stamps landed on different words. So the four combined vectors you end up with are four genuinely different points. The bag is no longer the same bag.
Oh, so filters plus position 1 is a different point than filters plus position 2. The position literally moves the word to a new spot.
Exactly. And that's the whole trick. The same token at two different positions becomes two distinct combined vectors. The same position carrying two different tokens becomes two distinct combined vectors. Order is now baked into the geometry, where the downstream machinery can actually see it and use it.
Okay, but adding bugs me a little. If I shove a position vector onto filters, haven't I corrupted the word part? Now it's not sitting where filters belongs anymore.
Fair worry. And the honest answer is, you've nudged it, yes. But two things save you. One, D is large. 1,000, several thousand coordinates. There is a lot of room. The position stamp and the word identity can occupy the space in ways that don't have to stomp on each other. Two, and this is the part people underweight, the whole arrangement is learned. The model is trained knowing the position vectors are going to be added on. So the embeddings and the position vectors get shaped together to coexist. It's not two strangers colliding. They grew up together.
Mark the status of that claim carefully. The mechanism, that position information is added onto the embedding to produce one combined vector, that is known, exact, load-bearing fact. The picture of, they grew up together so they don't collide, is a useful model of why addition works, not a theorem. Hold them at different confidence levels.
And I should be honest that there's more than one scheme for making those position vectors. In the original design, they were fixed. A pattern of waves of different rates, computed, not learned, so that every position got a distinct fingerprint. Other models learn the position vectors outright, one per slot. Newer ones inject position in a slightly different way again. But, and this is the part to carry with you, at this level, they're all answering the same question with the same shape of answer. Take a representation that is blind to order and add something position dependent so it stops being blind. The varieties are engineering. The principle is the one we just built.
So if I were prototyping a toy version, I could literally keep a little table, one vector per position, and add the right row onto each token's embedding before anything else runs?
That is exactly the prototype. A table indexed by position, each row a vector of length D added onto the token's embedding. That's a faithful version of the real thing. You'd be doing the same operation a production model does at this step.
And now ask the question that makes the stakes land. What if you skipped it? What if you left the position out entirely? Then, I'm out of coffee filters, and any scrambled shuffle of those exact words, filters, coffee, of, out, I'm, arrive at the machine as the same bag, indistinguishable. The model could not tell a sentence from a pile of its own words. Grammar, which is almost entirely about order, would be invisible to it. The thing would be word-aware and utterly blind to syntax.
Which is to say, omit position, and you haven't built a weaker language model, you've built a bag of words model wearing a transformer costume. That's the failure mode, and it's total, not gradual.
So the takeaway is one sentence. The core operation is order blind by construction, and we repair that. Before anything else looks at these vectors, by adding a positional encoding onto each embedding, turning a bag of words into a sequence the machine can read.
Each token is now a single combined vector, what it is, plus where it stands. Position is in the geometry. That's the last thing the tokens needed before they're allowed to start looking at each other, which is precisely what they do next.
We left the tokens standing in a row, each one finally knowing two things about itself, what it is and where it sits. Coffee at one spot, filters at the next, instead near the end, all carrying their combined vectors. And up to now, every one of them has been alone, a point in space minding its own business. That ends here. Because the whole reason this machine works is that the tokens are about to start looking at each other and asking, in effect, who out there has something I need?
Right, and let me make that concrete with one token. Take instead the last real word in our sentence. Its combined vector knows it's the word instead and knows it lands near the end. But that is almost useless on its own. Instead of what? The whole meaning of that word is parasitic on something earlier in the sentence. The vector for instead, sitting by itself, has no idea that the thing it's standing in for is coffee filters. It has to go get that.
So why not just let it look at everything? Average up all the other vectors, dump them into instead, and now it's seen the whole sentence?
Because then every token ends up as mush. If instead just averages coffee, filters, 11 p.m., the question mark, and the rest equally, you've handed it the blurry sum of the entire sentence. The one thing that actually matters, filters, gets diluted by everything that doesn't. Averaging is the opposite of paying attention. You need selection, not a smoothie.
Exactly. So the mechanism we're building has a name, attention. And the definition I want you to hold is this. Attention is the operation where each token gathers information from the other tokens by pulling in more from the ones that are relevant and less from the ones that aren't. The entire game is deciding, for each token, which other tokens are worth listening to. Everything else is bookkeeping around that one idea.
Okay, so how does instead decide that filters is the relevant one and the question mark isn't?
Here's the trick, and it's genuinely clever. We don't hard code any rules. Instead, we give every token the ability to do two complementary things. First, each token gets to broadcast a kind of request, a description of what it's looking for. We call that its query.
Define it precisely. The query is a vector, length D, same width as everything else in this machine, that one token produces to describe the kind of information it wants from elsewhere. It is not the token's meaning. It is the token's question.
So instead produces a query that, loosely, says, I'm a substitution word. I'm hunting for the noun I'm replacing. Show me the physical object this sentence is about.
And the query is a vector. So show me the physical object is really just a particular direction in the space?
That's the right instinct. It's a point, a direction, in that same high-dimensional space we built earlier. Now, the second half. If queries are requests going out, something has to answer them. So every token also produces a second vector that advertises what it offers. That one's called the key.
The key, a vector, again, length D, that a token produces to advertise the kind of information it can supply. Queries go looking, keys announce. They are matched against each other.
Oh, so a key is like the flip side of a query. The query is, here's what I want. The key is, here's what I've got.
That's it, exactly. And the matching is the whole point. For each token, you take its query and you compare it against the key of every other token. Where a query and a key line up, where they point the same way in the space, that's a strong match. That alignment is what we mean by relevance. Relevance isn't decided by a lookup table somewhere. It's just how well one token's query agrees with another token's key.
So, for instead, its query, I'm hunting for the object I'm replacing, gets compared against the key that filters is broadcasting.
And the key for filters is, in effect, saying, I'm a concrete noun, the physical thing in play here. The query from instead and the key from filters point in compatible directions. Strong match. Meanwhile, instead's query against the key of, say, the comma, garbage alignment, weak match. So filters lights up as relevant, and the comma doesn't, and we never wrote a single grammar rule to make that happen.
And I want to be honest about confidence here. The story, instead, is looking for the noun it replaces, is me narrating in English what a trained model roughly does. The mechanism, query compared to key, alignment equals relevance, that part is real. That's the actual arithmetic. The tidy sentence about what instead wants is a useful gloss on vectors whose real contents are smeared across all D coordinates and don't come with English labels. Hold those two apart.
Wait, that gives me query and key, two vectors. But the glossary you keep teasing has three. Why isn't the match enough? Once instead finds filters, why not just grab the filters vector and be done?
Good. That's the question that justifies the third vector. Stop and notice what two different jobs are happening. One job is deciding who to listen to. The other job is what you actually receive once you've decided. Those should not be the same vector.
Let me build out why. Suppose we use the key for both, for matching and for the payload that gets handed over. Then a token's advertisement and its actual contribution would be welded together. It couldn't say, match me on the fact that I'm a noun, but what I'll actually hand you is information about coffee making. We want to separate how findable a token is from what it delivers when found. So we add a third vector, the value.
The value. The vector a token contributes once it has been attended to. It is the payload. Keys decide whether you get picked. The value is what you pass along when you are.
So filters has a key. Find me, I'm the relevant noun. And separately, a value, which is the actual cargo that flows into instead.
Precisely. Three vectors per token, three distinct roles. The query, what am I looking for? The key, what do I advertise? The value, what do I hand over? Same token, three different hats, and crucially, three hats it can wear independently. That independence is exactly why one vector wouldn't do. One vector forces the three jobs to share a single description. Three vectors let the model tune each job on its own.
But these all come out of the same token. Where do three different vectors even come from? It only walked in with one combined vector.
From three separate learned transformations. Take the combined vector for a token, the one carrying its identity and position. Run it through one learned transformation, out comes the query. Run that same combined vector through a second, different learned transformation, out comes the key. A third transformation gives the value. Three recipes, each its own set of trainable numbers, all fed the same input.
And learned is doing real work in that sentence. Nobody sits down and writes the recipe that turns instead into hunt for the replaced noun. Those three transformations start as random numbers and get beaten into shape by training, which is a debt we keep promising to pay in part two. For now, the recipes exist, they're fixed, and they manufacture query, key, and value on demand.
And here's where your world of signal flow earns its place at the table. Think of each token's query as a sweep across a bank of sources. You're a synth patch, and your filter is sweeping the room. Not to silence everything, but to decide how much of each source to let through into your own signal. The keys are what each source resonates at. Where your sweep lands on a source, that source opens up. And what actually flows through, once it's opened, that's the value. Instead sweeps the sentence, lands hard on filters, barely touches the question mark, and pulls the filter's payload into itself.
Oh, that's nice. The query isn't a yes or no pick. It's more like a continuous, how much of you do I let in?
That's the perfect handoff to what's next, actually. Because right now, I've given you matches. Strong here, weak there. But a pile of raw match scores isn't yet a clean recipe for mixing. We still have to turn those matches into actual proportions that say how much of each value flows in, and then do the mixing. That conversion, and the weighted blend that finally updates instead, is the next move.
Say the three roles back before we go. Query, what a token seeks. Key, what it advertises. Value, what it delivers. Relevance is the match between a query and a key. Hold those four sentences, and the rest is mechanics.
Query seeks, key advertises, value delivers, and the match between query and key is relevance. Got it.
Three vectors, three jobs, no rules hard-coded. That's the engine. Now go make the matches add up.
We left the token instead in mid-gesture. It had issued its query, its question, and every other token in the sentence had laid out its key, advertising what it offers. And we said relevance is how well a query lines up with a key. But lining up is still a feeling, not a number. Before instead can actually pull anything in, that alignment has to become an honest, comparable quantity. So that's the first move. For each other token, we turn the match between instead's query and that token's key into a single number. Call it the raw score.
Raw score, as in before anything's been done to it?
Exactly before anything's been done to it. One number per pair. The raw score between instead and filters comes out high because that query and that key point the same way in the space. The raw score between instead and the comma, or between instead and 11 p.m., those come out low. Same query, different keys, different scores.
And keep the name clean. The raw score is the number we get from comparing one query against one key. It is not yet a proportion. It can be large, it can be small, it has no ceiling. Do not call it an attention weight. That word is reserved for later, and the difference is the whole point of this section.
Okay, so why isn't the raw score already enough? If filters scores high and the comma scores low, just mix in a lot of filters and a little comma. Done.
That's the natural instinct, and it almost works. But look at what those raw scores actually are. They're just sizes. Nothing makes them add up to anything in particular. One token might score 7, another a 2, another might come out negative. If I mix values using numbers like that directly, the total amount of stuff I pour into instead depends on how big the scores happen to be that day. Some tokens would get a fire hose, some would get drips, and the overall volume would wobble all over the place.
Which is a numerical mess. You'd be updating each token by an amount that has no fixed scale. Gradients hate that, stability hates that, and frankly, your intuition should hate it too. You want a budget, not a free-for-all.
A budget. That's the right word. So here's the rule we impose. Instead gets exactly one unit of attention to spend, and it has to distribute that whole unit across the tokens it's allowed to look at. Not more, not less. It can hand almost all of it to filters and a sliver to everything else, but the slices have to add up to one.
Picture it as a grid laid out in front of Instead. One cell per token it could look at. And Instead is given a single cup of water to pour across that grid. It can drench one cell and leave the rest nearly dry, but it cannot create more water. Every drop it pours into filters is a drop it cannot pour anywhere else. The total is fixed. The competition is real.
So attention is zero sum across the row? Paying more to filters literally costs it attention elsewhere?
That's the shape of it, yes. One cup poured across the grid, always summing to exactly one cup.
And the function that takes those raw scores and turns them into that distribution, the slices that add up to one, is called softmax. Let me build what it does, because it's two small steps and both matter. Step one, take each raw score and exponentiate it. That means raise a fixed constant to the power of that score. The effect is that every result comes out positive, no matter what the score was, and bigger scores get blown up much faster than smaller ones. A score that was a little higher becomes a lot bigger after this step.
So it exaggerates the lead. The token that was winning slightly is now winning by a landslide.
It sharpens the lead, yes. Step two, add up all those exponentiated numbers and divide each one by that total. Now everything is a fraction of the whole. Every value is positive, and because we divided by the sum, they all add up to exactly one. That's softmax. Raw scores in, a clean distribution out.
State it precisely. Softmax takes a set of raw scores and returns a set of numbers, each between 0 and 1, that together sum to 1. Those output numbers, those, finally, are the attention weights. The attention weight from Instead to filters is how much Instead listens to filters, between 0 and 1. And across the whole row, the listening adds up to 1.
Wait, say back the difference one more time so I don't blur them. Raw score versus attention weight.
The raw score is the unbounded comparison of a query against a key. The attention weight is what you get after softmax has turned the whole set of raw scores into slices of a single unit. Raw score, any size. Attention weight, a proportion, between 0 and 1, part of a budget that sums to 1.
And I'm highly confident this is real mechanism, not a teaching gloss. Softmax is the actual function in the actual code. The exponentiate then normalize, the sum to 1. That's literally what runs.
Now let's run our sentence through it. Instead's raw scores. High for filters, low for the comma, low for 11 p.m., middling for the rest. After softmax, after we exaggerate the lead and normalize to 1, the weight on filters comes out near 1. Call it 9/10. The weight on everything else is squeezed down towards 0, sharing the leftover sliver between them. So Instead is now listening almost entirely to filters, and barely at all to anyone else.
And that's because the exponentiate step blew up filters' lead before the dividing happened.
Precisely. The lead in the raw score became near total dominance in the weight. Okay, last move, and this is the one we've been promising. We finally used those weights. Remember, each token also produced a value. Its payload, the thing it actually contributes once it's been attended to. Instead, now builds its update by taking each token's value, multiplying it by that token's attention weight, and adding them all up. A weighted sum. Filter's value, scaled by 9/10. The comma's value, scaled by almost nothing. All summed into one vector.
So Instead's new vector is basically Filter's payload, with faint traces of everyone else mixed in?
That's exactly what it is. Because the weight on Filter's was near 1 and the rest near 0, the weighted sum is dominated by Filter's value. The vector sitting at the Instead position now carries the content of Filter's. Instead has reached across the sentence and pulled in what it was missing, the noun it stands in for.
A word whose entire job is to point elsewhere. Instead, a placeholder, empty on its own, has just filled itself with the meaning of coffee filters. It walked in carrying a question, and walks out carrying an answer. The grid was poured, the budget was spent, and the payload arrived.
Hold on, though. Instead sits almost at the very end. But there's still a token after it, the question mark. Did Instead get to pour any water onto that cell?
No, and that's a rule we have to make explicit, because it quietly becomes load-bearing later. When the machine runs, each token's query is only allowed to score the keys at its own position and earlier, never ahead. So Instead can reach back to coffee, to filters, to 11 p.m., everything behind it. But the position in front of it is walled off. It isn't in the grid at all. The whole cup of attention gets distributed over the current position and the past, and nothing else.
Why forbid looking forward?
Because of the one job this machine has: predict the next token from the tokens so far. If a position were allowed to peek at words that come after it, it'd be using the answer to compute the answer. So when we generate, we simply don't let it. Each token sees its own slot and everything behind it. Full stop.
Pin it exactly, because we will lean on this hard downstream. For any token, the raw scores against later positions are struck out before softmax, pushed so far down that their attention weight comes out at 0. The consequence is a property, not a preference. Attention here is strictly backward-looking. A token's updated vector is a weighted mix of values at its own position and earlier, and no information from a future position can enter it.
Real mechanism, actual code, not a teaching simplification. The usual name is causal masking. Causal because cause runs forward in time. The past can shape the present. The future cannot reach back and touch it. Confidence? High. Remember this one. It's the fact a lot of later machinery quietly stands on.
So the picture sharpens. Instead doesn't survey the sentence freely in all directions. It looks over its shoulder, at filters, at coffee, at the shortage it's standing in for, and never ahead. The reach is real. It only ever reaches backward.
One more caution before anyone overreads the numbers. The weight being near one is this sentence, these particular trained transformations. Softmax doesn't always spike. Sometimes the cup gets spread thin across many past cells, and the update is a genuine blend of several values. Sharp here, soft elsewhere. That's why it's softmax and not just max.
Correct. And note what softmax bought us beyond tidiness. Because the weights always sum to 1 and stay between 0 and 1, every token's update lives on the same scale, no matter how big the raw scores ran. That stability is not decoration. It is what lets us stack this operation many times without the numbers exploding.
Which is the next thread. We built this four instead, with one set of backward-looking weights, one budget, one weighted mix. But a sentence has more relationships in it than a single budget can express at once. So the real machine doesn't run attention once. It runs several at the same time.
Several budgets all at once?
Several budgets all at once. That's where we go next.
We left the token instead mid-pour. It had one unit of attention to spend, one budget, and it spent almost all of it on filters. Clean, satisfying, and, it turns out, far too tidy, because that single pour quietly assumes instead has exactly one question to ask. It does not. It has several, all at once.
Several, It found the noun it stands in for, coffee filters. That's the relationship, right? Job done.
It's one job done, but look at everything instead is actually doing in that sentence. Yes, it's pointing back at the missing thing, the filters, but it's also sitting inside a frame, out of something, a shortage. That's a different relationship than just naming the noun. And there's pressure underneath the whole line. It's 11 p.m. This is the can't fix it tomorrow hour. Three different threads, and instead is tied to all three.
Okay, so why can't one budget just handle all three?
Because of exactly what we built last time. One attention budget is one set of attention weights, one weighting over the other tokens, summing to one. One opinion about who matters. If instead wants to listen hard to filters for identity and listen hard to out for the shortage frame, a single weighting has to average those two wishes into one compromise blend. You get neither of them cleanly. You get mush. The very thing attention was supposed to rescue us from.
So one weighting is one opinion, and our token is holding three opinions.
That's it. So the fix is almost embarrassingly direct. Don't make it choose. Run attention more than once in parallel. Each run gets its own query, its own key, its own value transformations, its own private way of deciding what counts as relevant. We call each one of those parallel runs a head.
Wait, several whole copies of the attention machinery? Query, key, value, softmax, weighted mix, the entire thing, several times over? That sounds like several times the work.
That's the part worth slowing down on. Each head does not work in the full width of the vector. Remember D, the model dimension, the length of every token's vector. We don't give each head all 1,000 or so coordinates, we slice it. Say D is 1,000 and we run 16 heads. Each head produces its query, key, and value in a slice of roughly 60 coordinates, its own little corner of the space.
A subspace. Say it precisely. Each head operates in its own lower dimensional subspace, carved out of the model dimension by its own learned transformations. 16 heads, 16 subspaces, each about a 1/16 of the width.
Oh, so because each head is narrow, 16 narrow heads cost about the same as one fat one. The total work stays roughly flat. You're not paying 16 times, you're spending the same budget of coordinates, just split into 16 jobs.
Exactly. The width is the same. We've just refused to spend it all on a single weighting. And here's the payoff. Each head carries its own budget, its own unit of attention, its own set of attention weights summing to one. So one head can pour almost everything onto filters, the identity question, while a completely different head at the same moment pours its budget onto out, holding the shortage frame. Two opinions, both expressed fully, neither one watered down by the other.
Picture it for instead. One head leans back toward filters. What am I replacing? Another head is tuned to the shape out of X. What's the nature of this lack? And a third has its budget drifting toward 11 p.m. How urgent is this, really? Three readings of the same word, computed side by side, in parallel, in one pass.
And now I have to step on the nice story because it's a story. I just said, this head does shortage, that head does urgency. Nobody assigned those jobs. The heads do not come labeled. What each head specializes in, if it specializes in anything clean at all, is learned, and a lot of heads end up doing some smeared mixture you couldn't put a tidy name on. So treat the grammar head, the shortage head, as a useful picture of what multiple budgets buy you, not as a spec sheet. I'm fairly confident researchers have found individual heads that look interpretable, but plenty of them just don't.
Got it. The labels are my interpretation, not a wiring diagram. But then, mechanically, what falls out the other end? I've now got 16 separate weighted mixes for instead, 16 little answer vectors. The token can't just be 16 things.
Right, so we have to put them back together. Each head, remember, did its own weighted sum of values inside its own narrow subspace. So each head hands back one short vector, its slice of the answer. We line all 16 of those slices up end to end, concatenate them, and that reassembles something the full width of the model again. Then one more learned transformation mixes across all of it.
Be exact about why that last mix matters. Concatenating just parks the 16 results next to each other. Head 1's findings don't yet talk to head 2's. The final transformation is what lets them interact. It blends across all the heads and projects the whole thing back down to a single vector of length d. That blend and project is part of the mechanism, not bookkeeping. Without it, you'd have 16 islands.
So combining the heads produces one vector per token again, same width as what went in. But now it's carrying the answers to several questions folded together.
That's the whole move. Instead, walks out of multi-head attention as one updated vector, same shape it had walking in. But that vector now reflects the identity answer, the shortage frame, and the urgency all at once. Because separate budgets gathered them separately, and the final mix wove them into one.
And that's the quiet upgrade. We didn't make attention smarter. We made it ask more than one question at the same instant, and forbid those questions from drowning each other out.
Let me check I can answer the obvious exam question. Why isn't one attention pattern enough for this sentence? Because instead relates to several other tokens in genuinely different ways. What it replaces, the lack it sits inside, the time pressure. And a single budget can only express one blended opinion. So you'd lose the distinctions.
Clean. And the second one, what does combining heads produce?
One vector per token, the full model dimension wide, carrying the results of all the heads' separate weightings, mixed together by that final transformation.
Both right. And keep the honest caveat stapled to the first answer. Multiple heads give the model the capacity to track several relationships at once. Whether any single head ends up doing one crisp, human-nameable thing is a separate, much messier question. The capacity is the mechanism. The clean labels are our hopeful narration.
One more boundary, so nobody overreads this. Every head here still does ordinary attention. Query against key, softmax into weights, weighted sum of values. Nothing new in the operation. The only new ideas are run several in their own subspaces, give each its own budget, and combine the results into one vector.
Which is the right note to end on? Because that combined vector is only halfway through its trip. Attention let instead gather from its neighbors. But gathering isn't the same as thinking about what you gathered. The next thing that happens to that vector, once it's done listening, is that it gets reshaped on its own, with no neighbors involved at all.
Wait, no neighbors? After all that work making the tokens look at each other?
After all that work, that's the part nobody expects. We do it next. So instead has finished listening. It poured its attention budgets across the sentence, several heads at once, and the blend and project folded all those answers back into a single vector of width d, the model dimension. That vector is richer now than the combined vector we started with. It carries traces of filters, of the out of something shortage frame, of the late hour. And the very next thing the machine does to it is stop talking to the neighbors entirely.
Wait, stop? We just spent two whole sections getting these tokens to talk to each other.
We did. And now each token walks off into a corner and thinks by itself, with no neighbors involved at all. That's the second half of the unit. Attention was the part where tokens gather information. This next part, the feed-forward network, is the part where a token sits with what it gathered and works it over, privately.
Name the container first. The repeating unit, attention, then this feed-forward network, plus a couple of pieces we add next time, is called the transformer block. One block is one round of gather, then think. The whole model is this block, stacked. So fix the term now. Transformer block, the unit that refines each token's vector.
Okay. And the feed-forward network is the think privately half.
Exactly. Let me build it, because it's almost embarrassingly plain compared to attention, and that plainness is the point. Take instead's vector, length d. Say d is 1,000. Step one, multiply it by a learned matrix that makes it wider, much wider. A common choice is 4 times d. So 1,000 numbers go in, and 4,000 come out.
Why blow it up? That seems backwards. We worked hard to get one tidy vector.
Because width is room to work. Picture it as temporarily spreading the vector across 4,000 scratch dimensions so the network has space to pull it apart, test it against many little learned patterns at once. Then, step two, a second learned matrix squeezes those 4,000 numbers back down to 1,000. Out comes a vector the same shape it went in, with D again, wide in the middle, narrow at the ends.
And between the two steps, there is one more thing. or the whole structure is a lie. State it.
Right. Between the expand and the squeeze, there's a nonlinearity. A simple gate applied to each of those 4,000 numbers. Roughly, keep the positive parts, flatten the rest towards zero. Without that gate, two matrix multiplications in a row would just collapse into a single matrix multiplication, and the 4,000-wide detour would buy you nothing. The bend in the middle is what makes the two layers actually two layers.
So it's stretch it wide, bend it, fold it back. Stretch, bend, fold.
Stretch, bend, fold. That's the feedforward network. Two learned matrices with a nonlinear gate between them apply to one token's vector.
And here's the part people skip. That little stretch, bend, fold is where most of the model's weights actually live. Not the glamorous attention. This. The expand matrix and the squeeze matrix, 4,000 by 1,000 each, repeated in every block. Roughly two-thirds of the parameters in a typical transformer are sitting in these feed-forward networks. The unsexy part is most of the machine.
Think about what that means at scale. The operation everyone tells stories about, tokens reaching across a sentence, attending to one another, that's the thin, elegant wiring. But the sheer mass of the thing, the bulk where the model stores what it has learned about how the world tends to go, that lives in these quiet, per-token transformations, multiplied across dozens of blocks. The cathedral is mostly stone you never look at.
Okay, that reframes it. But I still want the mechanism nailed down. You keep saying per token. How separate is separate?
Completely separate. This is the load-bearing fact of the whole section, so let me say it carefully. The feed-forward network takes one token's vector in and produces one token's vector out. While it's chewing on instead, it cannot see filters. It cannot see 11 p.m. It has no access to any other position in the sentence. Each token is processed independently of its neighbors.
But it's the same network for every token?
Same network, identical weights, the exact same expand matrix, the same gate, the same squeeze matrix get applied to coffee, to filters, to instead, to the question mark. One function runs separately on each position.
Then be precise about why the outputs differ. Same function, different inputs. The feedforward network is a fixed function. Instead's vector and filter's vector are different vectors going in, so they come out as different vectors. The network doesn't know which token it's looking at. It only ever sees a point of length D and reshapes it.
Which is exactly the right confidence level to hold. The network has no idea it's instead. It's reshaping a vector. That the vector happens to mean instead after gathering context is something attention arranged one step earlier. The feed-forward network just does its fixed job on whatever shows up.
So if attention had already loaded instead's vector with this is standing in for filters and there's a shortage and it's late, what does the reshaping actually do to that?
That's the satisfying case. The mixed vector arrives carrying several ingredients smeared together. Substitute for a noun, the shortage frame, the urgency. The feed-forward network is the step that can take that raw mixture and reshape it into something more committed. Loosely, it can recognize out of X asking for a substitute as a configuration it has seen a million times in training, and push the vector toward whatever that pattern entails. Attention assembled the ingredients. This step cooks them.
Flag that as gloss, not mechanism. We can't open the network and find a neuron labeled substitute request. What we can say firmly is the structural fact. Attention moves information between tokens. The feed-forward network transforms information within a token. The cooking story is a useful picture hung on top of that fact.
Agreed, and that's the division of labor worth memorizing. Attention is horizontal. It moves things sideways, across positions. The feed-forward network is vertical. It works straight down within a single position, no sideways motion at all. Gather sideways, then transform in place. Every block does both, in that order.
Here's what's bugging me, though. Why bother keeping them separate? Why not let the thinking step also peek at the neighbors?
Two answers, and they're both good. First, you already have a tool for peeking at neighbors. That's attention, and it's the principled way to do it, with budgets and weights. Mixing that job into the feed-forward network would just be a sloppier second copy of attention. Clean separation. One part communicates, the other part computes. Second answer.
The second answer is that it's almost free.
Right. Because each token is independent, you can run the feed-forward network on every position at the same time. There's no waiting. No token has to hear from another. 1,000 tokens, the same stretch, bend, fold, all in parallel. One big matrix operation the hardware loves. Independence isn't just conceptually tidy, it's what makes this step cheap to run across an entire sequence at once.
And note what that independence forbids, because it sharpens the definition. If the only place tokens exchange information is attention, then remove attention from a block and every token is sealed off in its own tube. The feed-forward network alone could never let instead learn that filters exists. That isolation is not a flaw. It's the contract. All cross-token information flow is attention's job, by construction.
So the block has a clean shape. Tokens talk, that's attention. Then each token shuts up and thinks. That's the feed-forward network. And the thinking part is the same function everywhere, but lands differently because every token hands it a different vector.
That's the whole thing. And the output is, once more, a vector of length d for each token. Same shape we've been carrying since the very first combined vector. The machine is obsessive about that. Whatever happens inside a block, a token goes in as a length d vector and comes out as a length d vector, just a better one. Which is precisely what lets us do the same block again and again.
Except we're not quite safe to stack yet. We've got two transformations bolted in a row. Attention, then this stretch, bend, fold, and nothing yet keeping the numbers from drifting or the original signal from getting trampled as we pile on more blocks.
Which is the gap we close next. The two quiet pieces that let you actually stack this block dozens of times without the whole thing falling apart. Gather, then think. That part's built. Now we make it survivable at depth.
We have one block now. Attention gathers sideways, the feed-forward network thinks privately, and a single refined vector comes out the far end. But one block is not the machine. The machine is that block repeated, 12 times, 96 times. Picture a vector setting out down a long corridor of identical rooms, reshaped in every single one. And here is the danger nobody puts on the poster. A corridor that long will destroy whatever you send down it, unless you build two deeply unglamorous things into every doorway.
Destroy it how? Each room is only refining the vector, right? That sounds harmless.
That word refining is the trap. It sounds gentle, but remember what a block actually does. Attention pours in a weighted mix of other tokens' values, and then the feed-forward network stretches, bends, and folds the result. That is a big transformation. Run it once? Fine. Now run a fresh one of those. Its own attention weights, its own feed-forward weights. 50 times in a row. The thing that set out as the vector for filters can get rewritten so thoroughly that by the end, nothing of the original is left.
So the block is almost too powerful for its own good.
Exactly that. I want every block to be able to make a big change when a big change is earned, and to make almost no change when the vector is already in good shape. As we've built it so far, it can do the first beautifully, and the second, hardly at all. Even leave this mostly alone would cost the block a small miracle of precise tuning, because its only option is to output the whole next vector from scratch.
Which means the default behavior of a deep stack is to forget where it started. That's backwards. You want memory to be free, and editing to cost effort. Right now, it's the reverse, and the reverse does not survive 100 blocks.
So here's the fix, and it's almost embarrassing how simple it is. Whatever vector goes into the block, call it the input vector. We hang on to it. The block does its whole job, attention, then feed forward, the full round of gather, then think. It produces some output vector, but instead of passing that output straight forward, we add it back onto the input. Input vector plus the block's output. That sum is what moves on to the next room.
Name it precisely and keep the granularity clean. This is the residual connection. The definition. The input to a block is added to that block's output, and the sum is what propagates onward to the next block. We are wrapping the whole block in one shortcut, not slicing it into pieces. The consequence is the part that matters. The block no longer produces the next vector outright. It produces a change, which gets added onto the vector that was already there.
Oh, so the block isn't writing the whole next version of the vector. It's writing a diff? A list of edits laid on top of what was already sitting there?
A diff. That's the perfect word for it. The original coffee filter's vector flows straight through the addition, untouched, and the block only contributes adjustments stacked on top. And here's the payoff. If a block has nothing useful to add, it can output near zero, and the vector sails through completely unchanged, for free. No precise tuning required to preserve it. Preservation is now the default. The block has to spend effort only when it actually wants to edit.
Now memory is free, and editing is the deliberate act. That is the right way around. And I'll put my confidence high here. This one trick is most of the reason deep stacks function at all. It's the difference between a corridor that erases you and a corridor that lets you through.
And sending the original straight down the corridor like that, does it help with anything besides not forgetting?
There's a second payoff, and it lands in part two when we get to training. That same shortcut gives the learning signal a clean path straight back through the whole stack, instead of forcing it to claw its way through every transformation. Hold that thought. It's a genuine reason residuals matter, but the proper word for that backward signal comes later. For inference, the point is the simple one. The original survives, and each block edits the margins.
Okay, but wait. If every block keeps adding its output onto the running vector, doesn't the thing just keep growing? Add, 50 times over?
You just walk straight into the second problem, and it's real. Addition accumulates. Each block's residual piles another contribution onto the heap, and across dozens of blocks, the sheer magnitude of the numbers in that vector starts to drift. Some coordinates swelling up, others collapsing toward nothing. And the next block was tuned expecting numbers in a sane range. Hand it numbers that are 10 times too large, and all its careful behavior falls apart.
This is what the second piece protects against: layer normalization. State it cleanly and at the same granularity. Before a block reads the vector is rescaled so that its coordinates sit in a stable, consistent statistical range, recentered, and squeezed to a steady spread. So each block sees a freshly rescaled vector on the way in, and the residual still carries the unrescaled original forward, untouched. The result is that every transformation downstream always reads inputs of a familiar size, no matter how many additions happened upstream.
So it just resets the numbers back to a consistent scale before each block runs?
That's the core of it. And it does the rescaling per token, independently. Same spirit as the feedforward network. Each token's vector is normalized using only its own numbers. Filters gets rescaled using its own coordinates, instead using its own, no peaking across tokens. So one loud token can't blow out the scale for its neighbors.
And there's a knob the model can learn there too, right? It's not a hard, fixed reset.
Right. After the rescaling, there are a couple of learned numbers per coordinate that let the model stretch or shift the normalized values back to whatever spread the next block actually prefers. So it's not force everything to one rigid shape forever. It's pin the scale to something sane, then let training decide the comfortable range from there. The protection is automatic. The fine adjustment is learned.
And I want to be honest about the status of these two pieces because people romanticize them. The residual connection and layer normalization are not where the intelligence lives. Nobody points at them and says, that's where the model understood the substitution. They are plumbing. But they are the plumbing that makes depth physically possible. Take them out, and the cleverness upstream never gets to accumulate because the corridor eats it.
So let me make sure I've actually got the two failure modes straight. If you ripped out the residual connections, what breaks?
Each block would be forced to regenerate the entire next vector from scratch, including faithfully reproducing everything worth keeping. Preservation stops being free. The original coffee filter's signal gets overwritten a little more in every room. And by the deep layers, the early information has been trampled. Exactly the word we used before. The stack can't hold a thought across its own depth.
And if you ripped out layer normalization instead?
Then the additions accumulate unchecked, the magnitudes drift, and somewhere down the corridor, a block receives numbers wildly outside the range it was tuned for and produces garbage. So, one sentence each. Residual connections protect against the original signal being trampled as you stack. Layer normalization protects against the numbers drifting out of a sane range as you stack. Different problems, both fatal to depth, both solved by something almost insultingly simple.
And note that the two pieces work in concert at one consistent seam. Layer normalization conditions the numbers going into the block, the The residual carries the original around the block and adds the block's diff back on. One rescales the input, the other preserves the original and graphs the edit on top. Same granularity, same doorway, two complementary jobs.
And that's the quiet truth of the deep stack. The parts everyone tells stories about, the attention, the gathering, the matching of query to key, those are the parts that look like thinking. But none of them would survive being repeated 100 times without these two humble doorways. A shortcut that lets the original pass through untouched, a rescaling that keeps the numbers honest. With those in place, the block stops being a single, clever room and becomes something you can stack and stack and stack. Which is exactly the question we open next. What does the vector for instead actually become as it travels down 96 of these rooms?
Survives the corridor. Now let's see where it leads.
Picture the token instead standing at the mouth of a corridor. Not a short corridor, 96 doorways, one after another, each opening onto a room that looks exactly like the last. The same gather then think, the same quiet plumbing holding it together. We left it there last time, mid-question, asking what it would become by the far end. So let's actually walk it down the hall. Because the word that goes in the first door is barely a word. It's a dictionary entry with a position stamp. And the thing that comes out the last door knows it's part of a plea for a substitute at 11 at night. Same vector, 96 rooms.
And I want to be precise about what travels down that corridor because we're about to give it a name. One room, one block, does two things we already built. Attention pours in a weighted mix of the other token's values. Then the feed-forward network stretches, bends, and folds that result within the token. Residual connections keep the through line intact. Layer normalization keeps the magnitude same. That's a block. The corridor is just that block, stamped out dozens of times, each copy with its own learned weights.
Okay, so the vector for instead goes in, gets edited, comes out, goes into the next block, gets edited again. What do we call the thing in between? Because it's not the embedding anymore, it's been through attention. But it's not the final answer either.
Right, and that in-between thing deserves its own handle, because we're going to be talking about it for the rest of the series. The vector for a token, as it sits between two blocks, after some rooms, before others, we call the hidden state. I'll often just say a token's hidden vector and write it as H. Same length as everything we've carried. D, the model dimension. 1,000 numbers, say. What changes from block to block is not its shape. It's its contents.
Let me pin that, because hidden is doing real work in the name. The hidden state is the token's representation at a given depth in the stack. The vector H that block number 5 hands to block number 6. It is hidden in the sense that nobody designed its coordinates, and nobody reads them directly during normal use. They are the model's private working notes. Not the input, not the output, the evolving middle.
So H is the running draft of what this token means, and each block scribbles edits onto the draft.
That's exactly the diff framing from last time, carried up a level. Each block writes a list of edits on top of the existing hidden vector. The residual is what makes the previous draft survive into the next room, instead of getting thrown away and rewritten from scratch. So H at depth 90 is, quite literally, the original embedding plus 89 rooms worth of accumulated edits.
But here's what I actually want to know. If every room is the same shape of operation, what's different about the edits the early rooms write versus the late ones? Why would walking further down the hall make the meaning deeper instead of just more scrambled?
Good. That's the real question of this section. And the honest answer is, we don't get to assign jobs to the rooms. Nobody tells block 3, you handle grammar, and block 80, you handle intent. But when researchers go in afterward and probe what the hidden states actually encode at different depths, a gradient shows up. It's remarkably consistent. Let me trace it on instead, because it's the cleanest token we've got. At the very start, before any block, the hidden vector for instead is almost nothing. It's the embedding for the word instead, the bare dictionary sense, plus its position stamp. It does not yet know there's a coffee filter anywhere in the sentence. It's a word in isolation that happens to be standing in a particular spot.
Right, because attention hasn't run yet. It hasn't looked at anyone.
Exactly. Now, the first few rooms. Early attention tends to do close, local, almost mechanical work. Who's next to whom? What's the part of speech? What little grammatical bracket am I inside? So after a handful of blocks, the hidden vector for instead has picked up things like, I'm an adverb. I'm near the end of the sentence. I'm sitting after a comma. I'm inside a question. Surface structure. The shape of the sentence rather than its point.
And I want to flag the confidence level here because it matters. Early layers do syntax, late layers do semantics, is a real, repeatedly observed pattern. I'm fairly confident in the broad gradient. But it is a gradient, not a rule with sharp walls. It is not the case that block 12 is the grammar block and block 13 is the meaning block. The information smears across depth the same way it smears across coordinates. Treat the early versus late story as a reliable tendency you can reason with, not as wiring you could point to.
That's the right caution. So with that caveat, keep walking. As instead goes deeper, its attention reaches further and pulls in more abstract company. Somewhere in the middle of the stack, the hidden vector starts encoding the relationship the word actually carries. I'm not just an adverb near a comma. I'm the thing that points back at a noun the speaker no longer has. And which noun? The query it issues now lands hardest on filters. So the hidden state for instead begins to absorb filters, the missing object, into itself.
Wait, so by the middle of the corridor, the vector sitting at instead has kind of swallowed filters? It's carrying the thing it replaces?
A piece of it, yes. That's what the weighted mix does. It literally folds filter's payload into instead's hidden vector. And the feedforward network then reshapes that blend into something more useful than either word alone. By the later rooms, the draft at instead isn't really about the word instead at all anymore. It encodes something closer to a request to replace a specific physical object that's run out. The surface word has burned away. What's left is the function the word serves in the meaning.
Think about what that means as a journey. The token entered the corridor as a spelling. It leaves as an intention. Nothing along the way is magic. Every room only ever did gather, then think, gather, then think. And yet the cumulative effect is that surface form melts upward into purpose. The sentence stops being letters arranged in time and becomes, this person needs a substitute, and they need it now.
I want a mental picture for each room commits to a little more structure. Is there a clean one?
There's a bridge from your world, and I want to fence it carefully before I use it. Think of a signal chain, a sound coming in raw, then passing through stage after stage, each one committing to more shape than the last. First stage barely touches it. Then a filter decides which frequencies matter. Then a stage that responds to the envelope. Then something that reacts to the overall character of the sound rather than any single sample. By the end of the chain, late stages are reacting to high-level features that the raw input didn't visibly contain. They emerged from the processing.
And here's the fence. That's an analogy, full stop. The transformer is not a fixed signal chain with one assigned effect per stage. The rooms are general purpose, the labor isn't pre-divided, and the audio metaphor will mislead you if you push it. What the analogy gets right, and only this, is the direction of travel. Early stages commit to local, concrete structure. Late stages respond to abstract, whole input structure. Borrow the arrow. Leave the rest of the rack behind.
Agreed. And that's exactly the slice I wanted. The useful import is the gradient from concrete to abstract as you go deeper, plus the fact that the late stage features are built out of, but not visible in, the raw input. Everything else about the chain, discard it.
One more thing must be exact, because the next part of the series leans on it. We have been tracing instead. But instead is not the last token in the sentence. The sentence ends, what mechanically is the final position?
The final token is the question mark. What can I use instead? The question mark is the last thing in the input.
Then say precisely why that position is special. Every token, at every depth, has its own hidden state evolving down the corridor in parallel. Coffee has one. Filters has one. Instead has one. The question mark has one. They all refine simultaneously. but only one of them is allowed to have looked at the entire sentence and stands at the place where the next word will be predicted. That is the last position. Its hidden vector is where we will read off what the model thinks comes next.
Hold on. Why the last one specifically? Why isn't instead's hidden state, with all that substitute meaning baked in, the place to read intent?
Because of what the machine is built to do. Predict the next token, one position at a time. The prediction for the word after the question mark is computed from the question mark's hidden state. That final position is the only one whose job is to summarize everything so far and lean forward into what follows. And to do that summarizing, it has spent 96 rooms attending back over the whole sentence, pulling in coffee, filters, 11 p.m., the shortage, the urgency, the substitute request that, instead, worked so hard to encode. All of it flows forward and pools at the last position.
Oh, so the final token's hidden state isn't competing with instead's. It's downstream of it. It's where all the per token meaning drains to, because that's the position that gets to see everything.
That's the whole idea. Every token did its own refinement, but the last position is the collection point. By the top of the stack, its hidden vector is the closest thing the model has to a single answer to, given all of this, what now? That's why, when we want to read off intent, when we want to know that the machine has understood this as a request for a substitute rather than, say, a complaint about insomnia, the last position's hidden vector is the natural place to look.
And I'll put a number on my confidence. The claim, the final position's top layer hidden state is where the model's next token decision is staged. That's not interpretation, that's mechanism. I'm essentially certain on it. It falls directly out of how the thing is wired. The softer claim is the word intent. We're using intent as a convenient label for a particular pooled hidden vector. It is not a little homunculus deciding things. It's a thousand numbers that happen to be extremely predictive of the right continuation. Useful to call it intent, don't reify it.
Still, sit with the shape of it for a moment. 96 rooms ago, the last position was a question mark, a piece of punctuation with a position stamp and nothing to say. And by riding the same gather-then-think operation that every other token rode, drinking in the whole sentence as it climbed, that humble mark has become the place where the entire night's problem is held in a single vector. The coffee, the filters, the missing thing, the lateness, the asking, all of it pooled and ready.
So, if I had to answer your two questions back to you, early layers hold surface stuff. What the token is, what's next to it, what grammatical slot it's in. Late layers hold meaning and role. What this token is doing in the sentence, what it refers to, what's being asked. And the final token's hidden state is the read-off point because it's the only position that's both seen everything and is standing where the next word gets decided.
That's it, exactly, with auditors' two fences kept up. Early to late is a gradient, not labeled rooms. And intent is a label of convenience for a pooled vector, not a ghost.
Then state the close cleanly. We now have, sitting at the top of the stack, at the final position, one hidden vector of length D. It is the model's whole digested understanding of the input, staged at the exact place a next word is required.
And we have not actually turned it into a word yet. It's still 1,000 numbers.
1,000 numbers. The next move is the one everyone's been waiting for since the first sentence of this series, turning that final hidden vector into an actual next word.
Which is where the machine finally stops thinking and commits to saying something. That's next.
We have spent this whole series carrying one vector through the dark. 11 words went in. They became points. The points learned where they sat. They listened to each other, gathered, refined, block after block after block, until, at the very last position, sitting under the question mark, there is a single vector. The model's whole reading of your late-night plea folded into one list of numbers. And now, the machine has to open its mouth.
Right, so let's be precise about what we're holding. At the final position, the question mark, we have the hidden vector. Call it the final hidden vector. It's the same shape we've carried the entire time, a list of D numbers, the model dimension, 1,000 or so coordinates. That vector is rich. but it's still just an internal representation. It is not yet a word. There's one more transformation to go.
And this is the part I've actually been waiting for. We've got this one beautiful vector. How does that become paper towel?
Here's the move. The model has a vocabulary, the fixed set of tokens it's allowed to read and produce. Tens of thousands of them. Every word piece it knows lives in there. And the final step asks one question, once per token. How much does this final hidden vector vouch for you?
Be exact about the output. For every single token in the vocabulary, you produce one number, one raw vocabulary score. If the vocabulary has 50,000 tokens, this step produces 50,000 numbers. That full list of raw vocabulary scores has a name, the logits.
Logits. So the logits are just one raw vocabulary score per possible next word?
One logit per token in the vocabulary, yes. And the word raw is load-bearing here. They are not probabilities. They are not bounded. A logit can be large, small, negative, anything. It is an unnormalized vouching number, nothing more.
Which is the distinction people fumble constantly, so let me nail it. Logits are raw vocabulary scores. Probabilities are what you get after you tame those scores. They are not the same object, and the gap between them is the entire content of this section. Don't blur it.
And mechanically, getting from the final hidden vector to the logits is the simplest thing we've done all series. Each token in the vocabulary has its own learned direction in the same space. The logit for a token is just how strongly the final hidden vector aligns with that token's direction. Strong alignment, big logit. We've seen this shape before. It's the same query meets key flavor of how well do these two point the same way? Do it once per vocabulary token, and you've got the whole list of logits.
Okay, so for our sentence, out of coffee filters, what can I use instead? What do the logits look like?
They lean exactly where you'd hope. The token U, as in you could use a paper towel, gets a high logit. A, as in a coffee filter can be replaced by also high. Paper, diving straight at the answer, high. And meanwhile, the token banana or thus or some random punctuation gets a low one. The logits are the model's unsmoothed opinion about every possible first word of the answer, all at once.
But an opinion in raw vocabulary scores is not yet something you can act on. You cannot sample from numbers that don't sum to anything. You need a probability distribution over tokens.
And we already built the tool for that, back when attention turned its raw scores into weights. Softmax, exponentiate, then normalize so the whole set lands between 0 and 1 and sums to 1. Same function we met then, new job. Feed it the logits, and out comes a probability for every token in the vocabulary.
So softmax takes the logits, the raw vocabulary scores, and turns them into actual percentages. U, 40%. A, 20. Paper, 15. And so on down the list.
Exactly that. Numbers you can act on. That distribution is the model's real answer to what comes next. Everything downstream is just how we choose to draw from it.
And note what we did not do. We did not just grab the highest one. We could. Take the top probability every single time. That's called greedy. It's deterministic, and it's often weirdly flat and repetitive. The interesting knobs are about how we sample, not whether we take the max.
Wait, so the model doesn't always pick its top choice?
Usually not, no. It samples. It rolls a weighted die. And the shape of that die is where the two knobs come in. First one, temperature.
Temperature. The single dial that decides whether the machine speaks like a careful clinician or a jazz improviser.
Here's the mechanism, and it's small. Before you run softmax, you divide every logit by a number, the temperature. That's it, one division.
And dividing all the logits by the same number changes anything? Doesn't it just scale them?
It scales them before the exponential. That is precisely why it matters. Softmax exponentiates. Shrinking the gaps between logits before exponentiating flattens the distribution. Widening them sharpens it. The division is not innocent.
Think of it as a dose. This is the clinical way to hold it. Temperature is the dose of randomness you administer. Turn the temperature down towards zero, you divide by a tiny number. The gaps between logits blow up. and the probability piles almost entirely onto the single top token. Low dose. The model is conservative, predictable, says, you could use a paper towel, basically every time. Turn the temperature up, you divide by a bigger number, the gaps compress, the distribution flattens, and tokens that were long shots get real probability. High dose. The model gets adventurous. Maybe it opens with paper, maybe A, maybe something stranger.
So low temperature, it always reaches for the obvious answer. High temperature, it's willing to surprise me.
And crank it too high, and the dose becomes toxic. Flatten the distribution far enough, and you're sampling near uniformly from 50,000 tokens. The model stops answering about coffee filters and starts producing word salad. There's a therapeutic window, same as any dose.
Which brings the second knob, because temperature alone has a problem. Even at a sane temperature, there's a long tail, thousands of tokens, each with a tiny probability. Tiny. But there are so many of them that collectively they're a real risk. Sample once and you might draw stapler as your opening word, just by bad luck from the tail.
So how do you keep the freedom without the garbage tail?
Top P sampling, also called nucleus sampling. The idea? Sort every token by probability, highest first. Then walk down the list, adding up probabilities until the running total crosses a threshold, P, say 0.9. The smallest set of tokens that gets you to 90% of the probability mass, that's your nucleus. Everything else, the whole long tail, you throw away. Then you renormalize what's left and sample only from that.
State the contrast cleanly. Temperature reshapes the whole distribution. Top P truncates it. It removes the tail entirely and samples from the survivors. They are different operations. They are routinely used together.
So for our sentence, with top P at 90%, U, A, and paper probably make the nucleus, and banana and stapler get cut before the die is even rolled.
Exactly. Top P decides which tokens are even eligible. Temperature decides how boldly you choose among the eligible. Together, they set the first word of the answer.
So, the takeaway, and I'm confident on this, the model produces logits, the raw vocabulary scores. Softmax turns those into a probability distribution over the vocabulary. Temperature reshapes that distribution, top P trims it, and then you draw one token. That's the whole road from final vector to next word.
One vector, 50,000 scores. One distribution. One draw. The machine has chosen its first word, and now it has to do the entire thing again. And again. That loop is next. One word. After 11 words went in, after 96 blocks of gathering and reshaping, after the final vector became a list of vocabulary scores, and Softmax turned them into odds, and a single token got drawn, all of that effort, that entire machine humming end to end, produced exactly one word. The machine has said, you. And now, it has to do the whole thing again.
Wait, the whole thing? All 96 blocks? The attention, the feed forward, the logits? Every step of that, just to get word two?
Every step. That's the part that surprises people. So let's build it carefully, because the loop is the actual shape of how an answer gets made. The machine doesn't write a sentence. It writes one token, and then it asks the same question again with slightly more text.
Okay, so concretely, what's the input the second time?
Take what you started with. 11 words. It is 11 p.m., I'm out of coffee filters. What can I use instead? A real tokenizer would split that punctuation off into its own slots. But we keep one word, one token for clarity. 11 words, 11 tokens, by deliberate simplification. So, under that convention, the machine produced you. You glue you onto the end. The new input is 12 tokens, your 11 plus the one it just generated. And you run that 12 token sequence forward through the entire machine, exactly the way you ran the 11.
And out the far end.
Out the far end, you read off the final position again, which is now you, not the question mark. Turn its hidden vector into logits over the vocabulary, softmax, sample. And maybe this time it draws could.
You. Then, you could. Then, you could use. Then, you could use a. A word at a time, each one earned by a full pass through the machine. The answer doesn't arrive. It accretes.
So the sentence, you could use a paper towel, isn't planned anywhere. There's no place in the machine that's holding the whole reply.
None. There is no draft of the sentence sitting in a buffer. At any instant, the machine knows only the token so far, and it produces exactly one more. The plan, if you want to call it that, lives entirely in the text it has already committed to.
Name it precisely. This procedure, generate one token, append it to the input, feed the whole sequence back in to generate the next, is called autoregressive decoding. Auto because the model's own output becomes its next input. Regressive because each prediction conditions on the prior values in the sequence. The defining property. The thing you produced at step one is part of what you read at step two.
Say that last bit back simply. The model eats what it just said?
The model eats what it just said. Each generated token is fed back in as input for the next step. That feedback is the entire mechanism. There is nothing else.
And this is why you can't just ask the machine for the whole answer in one shot. People assume there's a faster path, one big forward pass that spits out the full reply. There isn't. Not for generation. I'm highly confident on that.
Why not, though? It read all 11 of my words in one pass. Why can't it write all of its words in one pass?
Good. That's the right question. And the asymmetry is the whole point. When it read your 11 words, all 11 already existed. They could sit in the room together, attend to each other, the moment you hit enter. But the machine's own words don't exist yet. To predict word two of the reply, it needs word one of the reply as context, because word one is part of what word two is responding to.
Right. So word two literally can't be computed until word one has been chosen.
Exactly. And word three needs word two. There's a dependency chain. Each new token is conditioned on every token before it, including the ones the machine generated a moment ago. You cannot leap ahead, because the input to the future step doesn't exist until the present step finishes.
Reading is parallel. Writing is serial. That's the sentence to keep. Your prompt gets processed all at once. The reply gets dripped out one token at a time, each waiting on the last.
Oh, this is just a cube-backed worker. I build these. A job comes off the queue, the worker runs, and the job's output gets enqueued as the next job's input. You can't run job 5 until job 4 has produced the thing job 5 needs.
That's a genuinely good handle, and it's mechanism, not decoration. Picture it exactly that way. Each step is a worker pass. Dequeue the current sequence, run the forward pass, sample one token, append it to the sequence, push that back onto the queue. The loop drains nothing. It grows. Every cycle, the sequence is one token longer than the last.
And the worker never parallelizes the chain, because each item depends on the previous item's result.
Right, you could parallelize across different users' requests. That's a separate idea we'll get to. But within one answer, the chain is strictly sequential, step by step by step.
Let me make sure I've got the bookkeeping. At step 5 of producing the answer, what's actually going into the machine?
Walk it under our one word, one token convention. Step 1, input is your 11 tokens. Out comes the first answer token, you. Step 2, input is your 11 plus you, 12 tokens. Out comes could. Step 3, 11 plus you could, 13. Out comes use. Step 4, 14 tokens. Out comes a. So at step 5, the input is your original 11 prompt tokens plus the 4 tokens it has already generated. You could use a 15 tokens total. And from that, it predicts the fifth answer token, probably paper.
So the input at step 5 is the prompt plus everything generated through step 4.
Precisely. The model's input at any step is the full prompt concatenated with every token generated so far. Not a summary of them. The actual tokens represented in full.
Represented in full? You mean at step 5 it's rereading all 15 tokens from scratch? It doesn't remember the work it already did on you could use a?
In the plain version of the loop, the one we've just built, no. Each pass is a fresh forward pass over the entire sequence. The machine re-embeds all 15 tokens, reruns attention across all of them, reruns every block. It redrives everything it computed last step, plus a little more for the one new token.
Which is exactly as wasteful as it sounds. By the time you're a few hundred tokens into an answer, you're regrinding hundreds of tokens of past work on every single step just to add one word. It's correct. It's also embarrassingly redundant.
So we're recomputing the past, over and over, the entire conversation, just to bolt one more token onto the end?
As described, yes. And your instinct that this is wrong is the right instinct. Notice what gets recomputed. For each past token, the machine rebuilds the same keys and the same values it built last time, because those tokens haven't changed. You is still you. Its contribution to attention is identical at step 5 and step 6.
So why recompute something that can't have changed?
You shouldn't, and you don't have to. There's a way to store the past token's attention ingredients once and reuse them, so each new step only does the work for the genuinely new token. That's the fix that makes long generation tractable.
Because this is the loop that runs every time a model speaks. Token after token after token. A full traversal of the machine for each one. Multiply that by an answer hundreds of words long, by millions of users, and the question stops being, does it work, and becomes, what does each step cost? That accounting, what we keep, what we throw away, what we never recompute, is where we go next.
We left the machine in a loop, writing one word at a time, and quietly doing something obscene. Every single step, it took the entire sequence so far and shoved all of it back through 96 blocks. 11 words, then 12, then 13, recomputed from scratch every time. There is a debt being run up here, and this is the section where we stop paying it.
Right, so let's look at what actually happens on, say, step 6 of generating the reply. We've already produced 5 words, now the model needs the 6th. In the plain loop, it takes all 5 existing tokens plus the prompt and runs the whole thing forward again. Attention fires at every position. The feed-forward network fires at every position. And then, out of that entire computation, we keep exactly one thing, the prediction at the last position.
Wait, so all the work it did on tokens 1 through 5, it just throws away?
It throws away the prediction, yes. But here's the sharper waste. It didn't even need to redo that work. Think about what each earlier token contributes to attention. Remember, every token produces a key, what it advertises, and a value, the payload it hands over when something attends to it.
And those are fixed. Pin it down precisely. A token's key and value at a given layer depend only on that token's hidden vector at that layer, which depends only on the tokens before it. Because this is exactly the causal, backward-only attention we built earlier, where a token may score its own position and earlier ones, and nothing later. No token's representation can be changed by a word that comes after it.
Oh, so the key and value that coffee produced back in the prompt, they're identical at step 5 and at step 6 and at step 50?
Identical. Computing them again gives you bit for bit the same numbers.
Which makes recomputing them exactly as smart as it sounds. You're paying a supercomputer to re-derive a constant.
So that's the fix, and it's almost embarrassingly direct. The first time you process a token, you compute its key and its value at every layer, and you keep them. You stash them in a store that grows as the sequence grows. That store is the KV cache. K for keys, V for values.
Why those two and not the whole hidden vector?
Good, because those are the only things other tokens ever read from a past position. When the new token attends backward, it brings its own query, and it needs everyone else's keys to score against, and everyone else's values to mix in. Keys and values. That's the entire interface to the past.
Note what is not stored. You do not cache the queries of past tokens. A query is a question a token asked on its own behalf, once. Nobody attends to a query. So once coffee has asked its question, its query is spent, discarded. Keys and values stay, queries do not.
State it as the rule. The cache holds, per layer, per pass token, 2 vectors, the key and the value. Nothing else. That's the whole object.
So now walk step 6 again, but with the cache live. The 5 earlier tokens, their keys and values are already sitting in the cache from when we first saw them. The only genuinely new token is the one we just generated at step 5. So we run the forward pass for that one token. It computes its own query, its own key, its own value. We append its key and value into the cache. Then its query attends backward against every key already in the cache and pulls in a weighted mix of those cached values.
So the new word still gets to look at the whole past. It just doesn't rebuild the past to do it.
Exactly that. Full visibility, zero recomputation of what came before.
And feel what that does to the cost. The wasteful version. At step N, you process all N positions. Add a word, the bill for that step grows. By the time you're deep into a long answer, every single new word is dragging the entire history back through the machine. The total work piles up like a sum that keeps getting steeper. It climbs with the square of the length.
With the cache, the heavy part, running blocks, the feed-forward network, runs for one token per step. One. That cost is flat. It doesn't care whether you're on word 3 or word 300.
So it's totally free as the answer grows?
No, be careful there. The per-step compute for the new token is flat, yes, but that token still attends against everything in the cache, and the cache keeps growing. So the attention read gets a little longer with every word, and the cache itself takes memory. Two vectors, every layer, every token you've seen. Long context isn't free. It's just paid in storage and a slowly lengthening lookup instead of in full recomputation.
That's the honest accounting. We turned redo all of history every step into do one token's worth of new work, then glance back over a stored history that grows. The glancing back gets gradually heavier. The doing work does not.
And the correctness rests entirely on the one fact we pinned. Past keys and values never change. The moment that stopped being true, if a later token could reach back and alter an earlier one, the cache would be stale and reuse would be a bug. It is precisely that backward-only masking, the rule we put in place when we first built attention, that makes the cache exact, not approximate.
So it's not a shortcut that trades away accuracy. It's the same answer, just refusing to recompute a constant.
Which is the rarest kind of optimization, the one where you give up nothing. Take it.
So the loop has its KV cache now. Each new word does its small share of work and leans on the keys and values already stored from everything before it. Which leaves one last question hanging over all of this. What makes one of these answers fast, and another slow, and another expensive? We left a question hanging in the air. The machine is writing, one word at a time, reusing everything it can from the past. And yet, some answers come back the instant you hit enter, and some crawl out token by token, like the model is thinking through molasses, and some quietly cost a small fortune to produce. Same machine, same 11 words going in. So where does the difference live?
It lives in a split we already have described but never named properly. There are two completely different phases to answering your coffee filter question, and they have wildly different economics. Phase 1. The machine reads your prompt, the 11 words, it is 11 p.m., I'm out of coffee filters, what can I use instead? Phase 2. The machine writes its reply. You could use a paper towel, and so on. Reading and writing. And the thing I want you to feel in your bones is that reading is cheap per token, and writing is expensive per token.
Wait, that's backwards from how I'd guess. Reading and writing are both just forward passes through the same 96 blocks, right? Why would one token of prompt cost less than one token of reply?
Because of how the work gets packed. When the machine reads the prompt, it has all 11 tokens in hand at once. Nothing is being generated yet, so there's no waiting for the previous word problem. It can shove all 11 through the blocks in a single parallel sweep. One big computation, all positions at the same time. The hardware loves that. It's built to do enormous batches of arithmetic in lockstep.
Name it precisely. Reading the prompt is parallel across positions because every prompt token is already known before the pass begins. Writing the reply is serial across positions because each token must be chosen before the next one can be computed. That is, the serial dependency chain we established for autoregressive decoding. It is not an implementation accident. It is forced by the fact that the model's own output becomes its next input.
Okay, so reading is one fat parallel pass, and writing is a long, thin chain of little passes.
Exactly. And here's the part that surprises people, including me the first time. During writing, each step only processes the single new token. We built the KV cache precisely so that step 50 doesn't recompute tokens 1 through 49. So the actual arithmetic per writing step is tiny, one token through the stack. You'd think tiny arithmetic means fast and cheap. It doesn't. And the reason why is the most important intuition in this whole section.
This is where I plant a flag. What I'm about to say is real mechanism, high confidence, but I'm describing it at the altitude of intuition. The exact numbers depend on the hardware, the model, the batch size, and a dozen serving tricks I'm not going to pretend to cover. The shape is right. The decimals are not the point.
Good. So, to compute even one new token, the machine has to use all of its weights, every learned number in every block, the attention transformations, the feed-forward matrices, all of it. Those weights are huge, billions of numbers. They live in memory. And to do the math for that one token, you have to haul all of those numbers out of memory and into the part of the chip that actually multiplies.
Wait, you have to drag the entire model out of memory just to produce one word?
Every single step, yes. And that haul, that's the bottleneck. The multiplying hardware is so fast that it finishes its work and then sits there drumming its fingers, waiting for the next load of weights to arrive from memory. The arithmetic isn't the slow part. The hauling is the slow part.
Which flips the naive picture completely. People imagine these models are slow because they're doing so much thinking. For one token at a time writing, that's the wrong model. The chip is mostly idle. It's starved. It's waiting on a memory truck, not sweating over a hard calculation. I'm quite confident on that framing.
State the distinction cleanly, because it carries the rest of the section. Reading the prompt is limited by how much arithmetic the chip can do. There is plenty of work to keep it busy. Writing each reply token is limited by how fast weights can move from memory. Two different bottlenecks. One job is compute-bound, the other is memory-bound.
So, if writing is bottlenecked on hauling the weights out of memory anyway, and the chip is just sitting there idle while it waits, couldn't you make it do more work on that same load of weights? Like, get something extra out of the trip?
You just invented batching. That's exactly the move.
Picture it. It's 11 p.m., not just for you, but for 100 other people, all staring at their own version of the crisis. One's out of coffee filters, one's out of printer paper, one's out of guitar picks. 100 separate questions, 100 separate machines. No, one machine, one set of weights.
Here's the trick. Every one of those 100 users is mid-reply, each waiting for their next token. Each step for each user, you'd have to haul the whole model out of memory. But it's the same model, the same weights, for all of them. So instead of 100 separate trips, you make one trip. You pull the weights out once. And while they're sitting in the fast part of the chip, you run 100 users' new tokens through them together. One haul, 100 next words.
Oh, so the expensive part, the memory haul, gets shared across everybody in the batch. The 101st user is almost free because the weights were already on the chip.
That's the whole economic engine of serving these models. The memory haul is the cost. Batching spreads that cost across many requests. The chip stops drumming its fingers. Now it has 100 tokens worth of arithmetic to chew on per load. And it's actually busy. Throughput goes way up.
This feels exactly like a queue-backed worker. Requests pile up in a queue, and instead of pulling one job, running it, pulling the next, you grab a batch off the queue and process them in one shot because the expensive setup is shared.
That's a genuinely good handle for it. Same spirit. You batch when the per-job overhead dwarfs the per-job work. Here, the overhead is loading the model, and the work is one token's arithmetic.
And now the honesty tax. The picture I just gave you, 100 neat requests marching in lockstep, is the intuition, not the system. Real serving is messier. Requests arrive at different times. They're at different lengths. Some finish while others keep going, and there's a whole scheduling craft to keeping the batch full without making people wait. I'm flagging that as a useful model, not a wiring diagram. The load-sharing intuition is solid. The clean choreography is a lie I'm telling on purpose.
One more precision. Batching across different users' requests is a different thing from the serial chain inside OneAnswer. Within your single reply, the tokens still cannot be parallelized. Word 2 waits for word 1. Batching does not break that chain. It runs many people's chains side by side. Do not conflate the two.
Right. Batching makes the machine serve more people at once, but it doesn't make my one answer come out any faster word by word.
Correct. And that's the cleanest way to hold it. Now, let's cash all of this out into the actual question. What makes your answer fast, slow, or expensive? Start with cost, because cost is almost arithmetic. Cost tracks tokens. Reading tokens, your prompt, is cheap per token, because they go through in that one fat parallel pass that keeps the chip busy. Writing tokens, the reply, is expensive per token, because each one is its own memory-bound step.
So that's why the APIs charge more for output tokens than input tokens. The reply costs more per word than the prompt does.
That's exactly why. Input tokens and output tokens are priced differently because they're produced by genuinely different work. A long prompt is relatively cheap to read. A long answer is relatively expensive to write. Same number of tokens, different bill.
So if you want the assessment question version, name two things that make answering your coffee filter question slower or pricier. Easy. 1. A longer reply. Every extra word of, you could use a paper towel, or a clean cloth, or honestly a fine metal sieve, although, is another full memory-bound step. 2. A bigger model. More weights means a bigger haul every single step, which makes both reading and writing slower and dearer. Those are the two big dials.
And I'll add two more that are subtler. 3. A very long prompt or a very long conversation. Even with the cache, remember, the new token has to attend back over an ever-growing set of past keys and values. That lookup lengthens as the context grows. And the cache itself eats memory, 2 vectors per layer per token, which means long contexts crowd out the batch. Fewer requests fit at once, so the per-request cost creeps back up. 4. Being alone. If you're the only one talking to the machine at 3 in the morning, there's no one to share the memory haul with. Your tokens are expensive because nobody's amortizing the trip with you.
So I'm literally cheaper to serve at peak hours, when there's a crowd to batch me with.
From the provider's books, yes. Your lonely midnight token is the priciest token. Counterintuitive, completely real.
Then the latency story, stated separately from cost. 2 clocks. The first is time to first token. How long before any reply appears? That's dominated by reading your prompt. Longer prompt, longer wait before word 1. The second is the per-word pace after that. How fast the reply streams, which is dominated by model size and the growing context, one memory-bound step at a time. Fast first word and slow stream, or slow first word and fast stream, are different complaints with different causes.
So sit with the shape of it. A trillion parameter intelligence, and the thing that decides whether it feels instant or sluggish is something almost mundane. How often the weights get hauled out of memory, and how many people you split that haul with. Not the depth of its thought, the width of the road its own numbers have to travel.
And that road runs in both directions, which is the quiet pivot waiting for us. Everything we've said is about the frozen machine, reading and writing with weights that never move. But those weights had to get good somehow. Every number we've been hauling out of memory was set by something.
So take your sentence one last time. The coffee filters, the 11 p.m., the plea for Anne instead. We've watched it walk in as a question and walk out as an answer. Next, we hand the very same sentence to the machine before it knows anything, and we watch it become a lesson. For the whole of this series, the machine has been finished, frozen. We carried 11 words into it, and we let already good weights do their work. Tonight, just for this stretch, I want you to break that machine. Wind it back. Imagine the very same sentence, out of coffee filters, what can I use instead, arriving not at a polished model that knows what comes next, but at a machine that has never seen a single word in its life and has no idea. Same sentence, completely different job. This time the sentence is not a question to answer. It is a lesson to be graded by.
Okay, but graded how? If the model is running forward the same way it always does, embeddings, attention, the blocks, the logits, what actually changes when we call it training?
Almost nothing changes in the forward pass. That's the part people find strange, so let me say it plainly. The machine still does the exact same thing we spent this whole series building. It reads the tokens, it runs the stack, and at every position it produces the raw vocabulary scores, the logits, and softmax turns those into a probability distribution over the whole vocabulary. Identical machinery. The one new thing we add is an answer key.
Right. During inference, you ask the model what comes next, and you have no idea if it's correct. That's the whole point. You wanted it to tell you. During training, you already know what comes next, because you're handing it real text. The next word is sitting right there in the sentence. You're not asking, you're checking.
Oh, so the text is its own answer key.
That's exactly it. And that gives us a name. A training example is just a span of text, presented so that at every position, the next real token is the target the model was supposed to predict. The text supplies both the question and the correct answer at once, position by position.
Be precise about what position by position means, because it is the heart of this. Take our sentence and stop partway. The model has read, "It is 11 p.m., I'm out of coffee." Full stop, no further. At that position, what is the one correct next token? Filters. Filters. So at that position, the model is graded on one thing and one thing only, the probability it assigned to the token filters out of the entire vocabulary. Not whether it produced something reasonable, not whether a paper towel would also make sense later. The grade is the number it put on the actual next word in the actual text.
And here's the part that connects straight back to the serving discussion. Remember how reading the prompt was parallel, all positions processed at once, cheaply, before any generation began? Training is exactly that parallel read. The sentence doesn't become one training example, it becomes a whole row of them, all scored in a single forward pass. At the position after it, the target is. After is, the target is 11 p.m. After coffee, the target is filters. Every position quietly predicts its own next token, and every one of those predictions gets graded simultaneously.
Wait, so one sentence is dozens of little quizzes happening at the same time, not one big quiz?
Dozens of quizzes. One sheet of paper, one pass of the pen. That's why training scales the way it does. You don't pay per question, you pay per sentence. And the sentence hands you a question at every gap between words for free.
And now we need the number that turns all of this checking into something the machine can chase. Because the model put a probability on the right word is still just a feeling. We need to convert it into one hard quantity. The quantity has a name, and from here on, it runs the entire second half of this series. It is called the loss.
The loss. Spoken plainly, one number that measures how surprised the model was by the words that actually came next. Low loss means it saw the truth coming. High loss means the truth blindsided it. And I want to build that word surprise carefully, because it is not a metaphor here. It is the literal definition.
Let's build it from the one position we already have. The model is read up to coffee, and the true next token is filters. Out of the whole vocabulary, the model assigns some probability to filters. Call it the probability on the truth. Now, what do we want surprise to do? If the model gave filters a high probability close to one, it basically knew. Surprise should be near zero. If it gave filters almost nothing, a tiny sliver of probability, the truth was a shock. Surprise should be huge.
So surprise goes the opposite direction from the probability. High probability, low surprise. Low probability, high surprise.
Exactly the shape we want. And the function that gives that shape is the negative logarithm of the probability on the truth. Don't panic at the word logarithm. Just feel its behavior. Probability of 1, the negative logarithm is 0. No surprise at all. Probability of 1/2, a small positive number, mild surprise. Probability of 1 in 1,000, a big number, real shock. As the probability slides towards 0, the surprise climbs without bound.
And that quantity, the negative logarithm of the probability the model assigned to the token that truly came next, has a proper name: cross-entropy. For a language model, the loss is cross-entropy, and cross-entropy, said in words, is precisely this: your surprise, measured against what actually happened.
So can I say it back? The loss at one position is just how stunned the model was that filters was the next word. And if it half expected filters, it's only a little stunned. If filters came out of nowhere for it, the number is enormous.
That is exactly right. And the loss for the whole sentence is the average of that surprise across every position. One number, summarizing how surprised the model was by the entire run of true next words.
Which is why I like this objective. It's honest. The model can't game it by sounding fluent. It can't earn a low loss by producing something plausible. The only way to drive that number down is to have genuinely put high probability on the real next token. Every gap, every time. No partial credit for vibes.
Here is where your clinical instinct earns its place at the table. Think of a forecaster, someone who, every night, has to put a number on tomorrow. 90% chance of rain. And then the day happens. If they said 90% and it poured, they were calibrated. Their surprise is small. If they said 90% and the sky stayed bone dry, the world just slapped them. High surprise, high score against them. Cross-entropy is that exact scoring rule. It does not ask whether the forecast sounded confident. It asks, when reality landed, how far off was the probability you placed on it?
So a model with low loss isn't one that's right in some vague way. It's one that keeps being unsurprised by what really comes next.
That's the whole idea, and it's worth holding on to, because it reframes the entire goal. We're not teaching the machine facts directly. Nobody's going to write down, coffee filters have substitutes. We are simply going to push it over and over to be less surprised by real text. And real text is saturated with grammar, with world knowledge, with the fact that out of X tends to be followed by what can I use instead? To stop being surprised by that text, the model has no choice but to absorb the patterns that generated it.
Note one thing carefully, because the second half depends on it. The loss is a single number. I'll always refer to it just as the loss, and I will never use that same letter for the count of layers, that is, the number of layers, always in words. The loss is one scalar. And right now, for an untrained machine, it is large. The model spread its probability roughly evenly over tens of thousands of tokens, so the probability it placed on filters was minuscule, and the surprise was correspondingly brutal.
Okay, but a number that just says, you were very surprised, that tells the machine it's bad. It doesn't tell it how to get better. Knowing your forecast was terrible doesn't tell you which knob to turn tomorrow.
Now you've found the actual question. The loss is a thermometer. It reads the fever. It does not prescribe the medicine. One number, sitting at the very end of the whole computation, telling you how wrong you were, and somewhere behind it, millions upon millions of weights, every one of which had some hand in producing it.
And the move that connects that single number at the end back to every one of those weights. That asks, for each individual weight, which way should you have nudged to make filters a little less surprising? That move is the engine of the entire second half. We have the lesson. We have the grade. What we don't yet have is the mechanism that turns the grade into a correction.
So we end exactly where part two has to begin. The same 11-word sentence that we once carried gently through a finished machine is now a single drop of fever. Read off the end of a machine that knows nothing. One number, the loss. And next, we go hunting backward from it, for the slope beneath every weight in the dark. We ended last time holding a single number, the loss. One scalar, and it told us, honestly, how surprised the machine was by the word filters, and by every other word in the sentence. But a thermometer reading does not tell you how to cure the fever. The loss says how wrong. It says nothing about which way to turn. And the machine has hundreds of billions of tiny numbers inside it. So tonight we ask the first real question of the second half. Faced with one number at the very end,
How does each of those tiny numbers learn which way it should have leaned?
So let me reframe what the loss even is. Because for this purpose, we've been picturing it backwards. Last time we held the weights fixed and fed the sentence through. The sentence was the variable. The weights were the furniture. Now flip it. Freeze the sentence. The coffee filter sentence is locked in place. Every token fixed. The true next word after coffee is filters, and it stays filters. The only things we now allow ourselves to imagine changing are the weights themselves.
Wait, so the loss becomes a function of the weights? The input's just a constant now?
Exactly that. Hold the sentence still, and the loss is a function of the weights. Turn one weight, the loss moves. Turn a different weight, it moves differently. Every one of those billions of numbers is a knob, and the loss is the single dial they all feed into. Now pick one weight, just one, out of the billions. Leave every other weight exactly where it sits. Nudge that one weight up, a hair, microscopically, and watch the loss. Maybe it ticks down a touch, maybe it ticks up. That answer, which way the loss moved and how much it moved, for that tiny nudge, that is the whole game, for that one weight.
Then say it exactly. For a single weight, the gradient is two things bound together. The direction, does nudging this weight up raise the loss or lower it? And the magnitude, how steeply? Up makes the machine more surprised, or up makes it less surprised, and by a lot, or barely at all. Direction and magnitude, for one weight. That pair is its gradient, nothing more.
So for one knob, the gradient is which way is less surprised and how hard that direction pulls.
That's it. And make it concrete with filters. After coffee, the machine put some probability on filters. And last time we said low loss means it put a lot. Suppose it didn't. Suppose it only put a little and got surprised. Somewhere deep in the machine, there's a weight that fed into that prediction. Say, a weight in the feed-forward network of some middle block, the part that reshapes the running draft for the word coffee. Ask the gradients question of it. If I turned you up a hair, would the machine have put more probability on filters or less? If turning it up would have pushed filters higher, lowered the surprise, then increasing that weight moves you downhill. That weight wanted to be a little bigger.
Hold on. You keep saying the gradient is about the loss going up, but what I actually want is the loss going down. Which one does the gradient give me?
A fair catch. The gradient, by its strict definition, points the way that raises the loss. It answers which nudge makes things worse and how fast. To improve, you read it and go the opposite way. So when I said that weight wanted to be bigger, what I literally meant is its gradient pointed towards smaller, toward making it worse by shrinking, so the fix is to grow it. The gradient is the signpost. Which direction you then walk is a separate decision, and it belongs to a later section.
And I want to kill a misreading before it spreads. The gradient is not the update. It is not change this weight by this much. It's a reading. The losses slope under that one weight at the exact spot where you're standing. The instant any weight actually moves, every one of those readings is stale. They were true for the configuration you measured, and only that one. Treat them as a snapshot, not a plan. I'm fully confident on that distinction, and people who blur it stay confused for weeks.
Right, and that's why this is a per-weight quantity, not one number for the whole machine. The loss is one number, but which way is downhill is a different answer for every single knob. Turning weight A down might help. Turning weight B down might hurt. Weight C might do almost nothing in either direction. So you don't get one reading, you get billions of them. The losses slope under each weight, all measured at the same spot.
So it's not, the model is wrong by this much. It's, here's a personalized note to every weight saying which way to lean?
That's a good way to hold it. One number coming out, billions of little instructions reaching back in.
And here is where I'd ask you to stand somewhere. Picture the loss as a landscape, a vast, hilly terrain, but not the two-hilled postcard you're imagining. The number of directions you can walk in this terrain is the number of weights. Billions of independent compass directions, all at once. Your altitude, everywhere on this terrain, is how surprised the machine is. High ground is bad, surprised, wrong. The valleys are good, calm, unsurprised. The machine reading filters after coffee as the obvious thing it always was.
And the gradient is what in that picture?
The gradient is the loss's slope under your feet, but resolved separately along every one of those billion directions. For each axis, it tells you, tilt this way and you climb, tilt that way and you descend. And the steepness tells you how sharply. You are standing blindfolded on this terrain. You cannot see the valley. You cannot see anything. But you can feel, beneath each foot, which way the ground falls away.
And I'll be honest about the limits of that picture, because the grid world version is exactly the kind of thing you'd prototype to build intuition. So let's actually run one. Strip the machine down to two weights. Call them weight A and weight B. So the landscape is a real surface you could render and stand on. Right now, you're at a point where the loss reads, say, 2.0. You want the gradient. So you do the literal thing. You nudge weight A up by 1/100th and reread the loss. It comes back 1.98. It dropped. So along the A direction, up is downhill. The gradient along A points the other way, towards shrinking A. Now put A back and nudge weight B up by 1/100th instead. The loss comes back 2.03. It rose. So along B, up is uphill. The gradient along B points up.
So the two readings are, A wants to go up, B wants to go down, if I'm trying to lower the loss.
Exactly. Those two numbers, the loss's slope as you step east-west along A, and its slope as you step north-south along B, together are the gradient at that spot. And because one came back falling and one came back rising, the downhill arrow points up and to the side. Grow A, shrink B. With only two weights, you could draw that arrow on screen and watch it point into the valley.
And then you remember the real machine has not two axes, but on the order of 100 billion. And the screen, mercifully, cannot be drawn. The math of the loss's slope along each axis is identical. Your ability to picture it is what dies. So you trust the per-axis story and let go of the postcard.
But wait, if there are 100 billion axes, isn't measuring it on each one absurdly expensive? In your two-weight demo, you nudged a weight, re-ran, read the loss, put it back, and did the next one. Scale that up, and you'd rerun the whole sentence 100 billion times.
You've just discovered exactly why the next section has to exist. Yes, the naive way to get these readings is precisely what you describe. One nudge, one full forward pass, read the loss, undo, repeat. 100 billion times, per sentence. That's not slow, that's never finishes. The fact that we can get every one of those readings in roughly the cost of a single backward sweep, not billions of sweeps, one, is the whole miracle of the procedure we build next. For tonight, I only want you to know precisely what the thing is that procedure delivers.
Then let me pin it so it survives the night. A single weight's gradient encodes two facts and only two. One, the direction. Does increasing this weight increase the loss or decrease it? Two, the magnitude. How strongly, how steep that effect is, right here, right now. It is measured with a training example held fixed and every other weight held fixed. It is a reading, not a move. And there is one such reading for every weight, because which way is better is answered independently under each knob.
One more handle, because we'll lean on it constantly. A weight with a near zero gradient, flat ground beneath that foot, is a weight that right now barely matters to this prediction. Nudge it either way and the surprise hardly changes. A weight with a large gradient is one the loss is very sensitive to. A small turn there moves the outcome a lot. So the gradient also quietly ranks the weights. It tells you who's load-bearing for this particular sentence and who's a bystander.
Oh, so the steep ones are the weights the sentence actually has something to teach. The flat ones already agree, or just aren't involved.
Beautifully put. Steepness is how much this sentence has to say to you. A weight that's flat under filters has nothing to learn from filters tonight.
So hold the whole thing in one image as we close. One sentence, frozen. One number at the end, the surprise. And reaching backward from that single number, a quiet field of arrows, one beneath every weight in the machine, each whispering the same small instruction. Lean this way, by about this much, and the surprise gets a little smaller. We have the arrows' meaning now. We do not yet have the trick that computes them all at once without rerunning the world 100 billion times.
Which is the only thing standing between a definition and a machine that learns. So that's where we go.
We go find every one of those readings in a single sweep backward. That's next.
We left the last section standing on a vast, dark terrain, holding a single number, the loss, and a promise. The promise was that we could learn the slope beneath every weight at once. Not billions of separate measurements, one sweep. Tonight we make good on it. And the trick, when you finally see it, is almost insulting in its simplicity.
Let me first make the naive version concrete, so the trick has something to beat. We have the coffee filter sentence frozen, and we want the gradient for one weight, say a weight deep in the feed-forward network of some middle block. The honest way to read its slope? Nudge it up a hair, run the whole sentence forward through every block again, and see if the loss went up or down. Fine, that's one reading.
And you have 100 billion weights. So that's 100 billion forward passes for one sentence. At which point, training finishes sometime after the heat death of the sun. Not a plan.
Right. So there has to be a shortcut. But where does it even come from? Each weight is buried under, what, 96 blocks of stuff between it and the final number?
That burial is exactly the thing we exploit. Here's the shape of it. The loss doesn't touch that deep weight directly. The loss looks only at the logits, the raw vocabulary scores at the end. The logits came from the final hidden vector. That vector came from the block below it, which came from the block below that. It's a chain. And the rule for chains is, if you know how sensitive the loss is to a layer's output, you can work out how sensitive it is to that layer's input.
Name the quantity before you spend it. I want one word for how much the loss would change if this thing wiggled a little. Call it the blame on that thing. The blame on a logit. The blame on a hidden vector. The blame on a weight, which is just the gradient under another name.
Blame, good. I'll keep that handle. So the whole procedure is, blame arrives at the end on the logits, and we hand it backward, layer by layer, each layer passing a transformed version of the blame to the layer beneath it. That hand it backward sweep is back propagation.
Okay, but arrives at the end. Where does the very first blame come from? What's the seed?
This is the part I love because at the logits, it's almost embarrassingly clean. The blame on each vocabulary token's logit is just the probability the model put there, minus the probability that should have been there. That's it. For the coffee filter lesson, the true next token after coffee is filters. Suppose the model only put a little probability on filters. Then the blame on the filter's logit is negative, meaning push this one up. And every wrong token the model overfavored gets positive blame. Push you down.
So the seed of the entire backward pass is predicted minus actual. Confident on that. It falls straight out of cross entropy. No magic at the start. The magic is what happens on the way back.
Wait, so we don't even have to compute anything clever to start? We just subtract what happened from what we wished happened?
At the logits, yes. The clean form is a property of the loss we chose. Past that point, every layer earns its keep.
So let's take one step backward and watch what a single layer actually does. Because every layer does the same two-part job. A layer receives from above the blame on its output. It then produces two things. One, the blame on its own weights. That's the gradient we came for, the thing we'll use to nudge those weights later. Two, the blame on its input, which is, by definition, the blame on the output of the layer below it. So it deposits gradient onto its weights, and it passes blame further down. Deposit and pass. Deposit and pass.
So each block is like a relay station. It keeps its own cut of the blame for its weights and forwards the rest down the line.
That's exactly the picture. And now you can see why it's one sweep and not a billion. When I'm sitting at a given layer, I compute the blame on its output once. From that single quantity, I get the gradient for every weight in that layer and the blame to send to the next layer down. I never recompute the upper layers. Their work is already condensed into the blame that arrived at my door.
State the efficiency precisely. The forward pass touches every weight once to produce the loss. The backward pass touches every weight once to produce its gradient. So computing all the gradients costs about the same as computing the loss. One forward sweep, one backward sweep. Two passes, not billions.
Which is the whole reason this field exists. If gradients cost a forward pass apiece, nobody would have trained anything bigger than a toy. The entire enterprise rides on backward is the same price as forward.
But hold on. There has to be a catch. To pass blame backward through a layer, doesn't the layer need to remember what it did on the way forward?
There it is. That's the real cost. And it's not compute. It's memory. Let me show you why with the simplest piece. A weight on the forward pass multiplied some input number and sent the result onward. Now ask, how much does the loss change if I nudge that weight? Well, nudging the weight scales whatever input flowed through it. So the gradient for that weight is the blame on its output, times the input number it multiplied on the way forward.
So the gradient needs the input number that passed through during the forward run.
It does. And that input number is gone unless we saved it. So the forward pass can't just compute the loss and throw everything away. It has to stash its intermediates, the hidden vectors going into each block, the attention weights, the numbers feeding each matrix, because the backward pass will need every one of them to turn blame into gradient.
So answer the second question cleanly. What must the forward pass save? Every intermediate quantity that a weight multiplied, the intermediate values feeding each step. Without them, the blame arriving from above has nothing to multiply against, and the gradient cannot be formed.
And that's why training a model needs vastly more memory than just running it. Inference computes the answer and discards the scratch work. Training has to hoard the entire forward pass so the backward pass can walk it in reverse. The frozen machine version travels light. The learning version carries everything it touched.
And now watch the blame actually travel through our sentence. It begins as that clean subtraction at the logits. Filters wanted more weight. The imposters wanted less. It flows back into the final hidden vector at the question mark. Then it enters the stack. And here, the residual connections finally collect on a debt we promised two lectures ago.
Yes, remember the shortcut, the residual, where each block adds its edit on top of the existing vector instead of rewriting it from scratch. On the way back, that same shortcut is a clean highway for the blame. Because the block added onto its input, the blame flows straight through the addition to the layer below, undiminished, with each block's own contribution branching off it. Without that highway, the blame would get multiplied down through dozens of layers and shrink to nothing before it reached the bottom. The residual is what lets blame reach the deepest, earliest weights still strong enough to act on.
So, residuals weren't just for the forward signal surviving the stack. They're for the blame surviving the trip back.
Both directions, same shortcut, two payoffs. And the blame keeps going. It passes through the feed-forward network of each block, depositing gradient on those weights using the saved inputs. And then it reaches attention. And in attention, it lands on something we can actually narrate, the attention weights. The blame can say, in effect, the question mark, reaching back for what it should attend to, did not listen hard enough to filters. So the gradient nudges the query and key machinery so that next time, in a sentence shaped like this one, that listening is a touch stronger.
I want to fence that. The model decided to listen more to filters, is the story. The mechanism is blame, arriving at the attention weights, multiplied by saved forward numbers, producing a number that says which way to nudge. The intent language is a useful gloss on top. Don't mistake the gloss for the gears.
Agreed. No layer knows what filters means. Each layer runs the same two-part arithmetic, deposit gradient, pass blame, regardless of what the sentence is about. Can I try to lock this in with one of the bridges from earlier in the series? The generation loop was a Q-backed worker. Is this a second worker?
That's a clean way to hold it. Picture two workers over a shared stack. The forward worker reads the sentence, runs each block, and as it goes, it pushes every intermediate it computed onto the stack, the inputs, the attention weights, the saved hidden vectors. It ends by emitting the loss. Then the backward worker starts where the first stopped and pops the stack in reverse. Last in, first out. Each item it pops is exactly the saved value it needs to convert the incoming blame into a gradient for that layer's weights and to produce the blame for the next pop.
So it's strictly LIFO. The backward worker consumes the forward worker's scratch in the exact reverse order it was produced.
Exactly. The forward worker writes the tape. The backward worker plays it backward, and out the other end falls a gradient for every weight in the model. All of it, for the price of one extra sweep.
And to answer the question that's been hanging over the section, why backward and not forward? Going forward,
One input quantity fans out to affect millions of downstream things. You'd have to track all of them. Going backward from the single loss, you start narrow and the blame splits exactly along the wires it already traveled. One source fanning back. That's why the cheap direction is backward.
So the loss is no longer a verdict with no instructions. We've turned that one lonely number into a personal note for every weight in the machine. Which way and how hard? The terrain is mapped. Every knob now knows which direction is downhill. What we have not done is take a single step. We've only read the slope. The walking, how far we dare to move, and what happens when we move too far, is the next thing we build.
So we finally get to actually change the weights?
Finally. One small step against the blame. That's next. We ended the last stretch holding something enormous and completely inert. The backward sweep gave us a gradient for every single weight. Billions of them. One reading apiece. And remember what each reading actually is. It's the loss's slope under that weight. Which way is uphill and how steeply? That's all it is, a reading. It doesn't move anything. A barometer doesn't change the weather. So the question for this whole segment is the obvious one. We've got billions of little slope readings. Now, what do we do with them?
I mean, the gradient already tells you which way the loss goes up. So you just go the other way, right? Downhill.
What's exactly the instinct? And it's correct. The gradient under a weight points toward more loss, toward more surprise. We want less. So for that weight, we move it the opposite direction. If nudging the weight up would raise the loss, we nudge it down. If nudging it up would lower the loss, the gradient points down. So we move up, always against the slope.
Then let us pin the rule before it drifts, one weight at a time. Take its current value. Look at its gradient, the slope of the loss under it. Move the weight in the direction opposite that slope. That is the entire act. Against the gradient, never with it.
Okay, but move it? Move it how far? The gradient gives me a direction. It doesn't hand me a distance.
And that is the whole reason this segment exists. You've found the gap. The gradient gives you two things, a direction and a steepness. But the steepness is a local fact. It's only honest right where you're standing. It says, right here, the ground tilts this hard. It does not say, so walk 40 meters. Step a little way, and the landscape has already changed underfoot. So we need a second thing, a number that decides how far we actually commit per move. That number is the step size.
Its proper name is the learning rate, the step size, a single scalar. And the update is precisely this. The new weight equals the old weight minus the step size times the gradient.
Let's build that slowly because it's the load-bearing sentence of the day. Start with the old weight, wherever this knob currently sits. Take its gradient, the slope. Multiply that slope by the step size. That's how far and how hard we lean on this one reading. And then subtract it. Subtract because subtracting is what turns uphill into downhill. New weight equals old weight minus step size times gradient.
So new value is old value minus the step size times the slope. The minus is the part that flips uphill into downhill.
Correct. And notice the division of labor in that one line because it matters. The gradient is per weight. Every knob gets its own personal slope. The step size is global. One number shared by all of them. The same multiplier on every weight in the model for this step. Each weight decides its own direction. The learning rate decides how boldly everyone moves at once.
Right, and that's the picture of one step. Every weight simultaneously slides a little against its own gradient, all scaled by the one shared step size. You do that to the whole model in a single synchronized nudge. That synchronized nudge, repeated over and over, is the thing with a name, gradient descent. Compute the gradients, take one step downhill, recompute, step again. That's it, that's the engine.
And it is worth pausing on how humble a single step is. Picture the loss as a vast terrain. We stood on it earlier. Billions of directions you could walk, altitude being the model's surprise. Back propagation is the survey. It tells you, for every direction at once, which way is uphill. Gradient descent is the footstep. One small, deliberate footstep downhill. Not a leap to the valley floor.
a footstep, and then another.
So let me make it concrete with our sentence. The true next word after coffee was filters, and the model didn't put enough probability there. That's why the loss was high. After one of these steps, what actually changed?
Almost nothing, and that's the honest answer. The gradient told a great many weights, if you lean this way a hair, the probability on filters after coffee goes up a hair. So we lean them all by a hair. Run the same sentence through again, and the model is now very slightly less surprised by filters. Maybe it went from putting 2% on filters to 2.1. That's a real measurable improvement, and it is microscopic. One sentence, one step, one nudge. Nobody reached in and wrote a rule that says, coffee precedes filters. We just made the existing machine an imperceptible shade better at this one prediction.
Which sounds underwhelming until you remember how many times you're going to do it. But hold that thought. That's next segment's problem. This segment's problem is the step size. And the step size is where people actually get hurt.
Hurt how? It's just a multiplier. How much trouble can one number cause?
More than every other knob combined. Set it wrong and nothing else you did matters. I'm very confident on that. Let me give you the two ways it goes wrong.
Go back to the terrain because the grid world picture makes both failures obvious. You're standing on a hillside. The gradient tells you which way is downhill. The step size is how far you commit before you stop, look again, and resurvey. Now, first failure. You make the step size tiny, absurdly cautious. You shuffle forward a millimeter, resurvey, shuffle a millimeter, resurvey.
You'd get there eventually. You're still going downhill.
You would, and it would take you a geological age. That's the too small failure. It's not wrong. It's just unbearably slow. You burn enormous compute crawling toward a valley you could have reached far faster. Real training has a budget. Crawling wastes it.
Okay, and the other way?
The other way is more interesting and more violent. Make the step size too big. Now the gradient points downhill, correctly, but you commit to such a huge stride that you blow clean past the bottom of the valley and land partway up the far slope, higher than you started. So next step you survey again, see downhill, and take another giant stride, straight back over the valley to the other wall, even higher.
Wait, so going downhill makes you go up?
Each step is locally honest. Each step starts downhill, but the stride is so long that it overshoots the dip entirely and ends up higher than it began. Do that repeatedly and you don't descend, you bounce wider and wider, climbing out of the bowl instead of settling into it.
And this is not a metaphorical hazard. It has a concrete signature. If the learning rate is far too high, the loss does not decrease. It increases. It oscillates and then explodes, climbing until the numbers exceed what the arithmetic can represent, at which point the loss becomes not a number and the run is dead. That is the symptom. A loss that should be drifting down instead spikes to infinity within a handful of steps.
So if you ever wire up training and watch the loss rocket upward instead of easing down, before you suspect anything exotic, suspect the step size. It's the first thing to halve. It's wrong far more often than your gradient code is.
So why not just trust the gradient's own magnitude? It already tells me the steepness. Why bolt a separate step size on top instead of letting steep slopes give big steps automatically?
Good, because that's the trap that feels reasonable. The steepness is only true in an infinitesimal neighborhood of where you're standing. A very steep reading does not mean the valley is far away. It might mean you're on a cliff edge a centimeter from the bottom. Trust the raw magnitude there, and you launch yourself across the canyon. So the step size is really a trust dial. It says, I'll move proportionally to the slope, but only this fraction of it, because I don't believe the local reading holds very far. Small fraction, timid and safe. Large fraction, bold and risky.
So it's less, how far is the bottom, and more, how much do I believe this one survey?
Precisely. The gradient is a local truth. The learning rate is how far you are willing to extrapolate it.
One more. I keep wanting to file this next to temperature, from when we were generating words. Both are a single knob that scales something. Same family?
No. Different universe. Resist that. Temperature lives at inference. It reshapes the probability distribution over the next word, while the frozen machine is answering you. It changes nothing about the weights. The learning rate lives at training,
It's how far the weights themselves move when we improve the machine. One is a knob on the answer. The other is a knob on the learning. Don't let them touch.
And in practice, you don't even hold the step size fixed across a whole run. It's common to start a little larger to make early progress, then shrink it as you approach a good region. Big, confident strides while you're far out on the hillside. Smaller, careful ones as you settle in. But the principle underneath never changes. New weight equals old weight, minus the step size times its gradient. Direction from the gradient, distance from the step size. Repeat.
Direction from the gradient, distance from the step size. Subtract, because down is the opposite of up. And do it to every weight at once.
That's the whole rule. That's gradient descent.
So look at what we are finally holding. The loss told us how surprised the machine was. Backpropagation flowed that surprise backward into a slope under every weight. And now, at last, the slopes become motion. One shared step size turning billions of readings into one synchronized footstep down the hill of surprise. From a single sentence, the machine has been made one imperceptible degree better at expecting the world. One footstep. The only question left is what happens when you take that step a trillion times.
Which is exactly where we're going. Take the step.
So here is where we left it. One sentence. The true word after coffee was filters. We measured the surprise. We flowed the blame backward. We took one small step downhill. And the probability the machine put on filters crept up. From 2% to maybe 2.1. That is the entire return on one training example. One sentence, one step, a microscopic nudge across 100 billion weights. And if that were all that ever happened, you would have wasted an enormous amount of electricity to barely move a needle.
Right. That's the part that bugs me. 2.1%? That's nothing. If every sentence only buys you that, how does this ever turn into something that knows things?
It doesn't. From one sentence, that's the honest answer. The single update is supposed to be tiny. We made it tiny on purpose, remember? The step size is small, precisely so we don't overreact to one example. So the trick isn't the size of the step. The trick is how many times you take it.
And this is where the scale stops being a footnote and becomes the whole story. Our sentence is not alone. It is one drop. It falls into a body of text so large it strains the words we have for size. Call it the corpus, the full collection of writing the machine learns from. Books, code, transcripts, forums, manuals, arguments at 3 in the morning. Hundreds of billions to trillions of tokens. And this long, grinding phase, predicting the next token across that entire ocean, one step at a time, has a name.
Pre-training. Be exact about it. Pre-training is the large-scale phase where the model does nothing but next token prediction over the corpus. The same loss we defined, surprise at the true next token. The same backpropagation. The same gradient descent step. Nothing new in the mechanism. What is new is only the count. That loop, run on example after example, for an amount of compute that is hard to hold in your head.
And I want to be blunt about what pre-training is not. It is not someone loading facts into a database. Nobody writes down, coffee filters have substitutes, and files it under household. There is no rule table. There is no fact store. There is one operation. Guess the next token, get nudged. Repeated until the nudges add up to competence. I'm highly confident on that. The rule table does not exist.
Okay, but then I genuinely don't get how it ends up knowing that a paper towel works. If nobody ever tells it the rule, where does the rule come from?
Watch what our sentence is actually an instance of. I'm out of coffee filters. What can I use instead? Strip the specifics. The shape is out of something, reach for a substitute. Now, that exact shape is everywhere in the corpus. Out of butter, use oil. Out of a jack, the guy in the forum used a brick and a prayer. Out of guitar picks, a coin. Out of printer paper, and on, thousands, millions of variations on out of X, use Y instead.
Each one, on its own, a single drop.
forgettable. But the machine is forced, over and over, to predict the token that follows instead, following out of, following a named object. And the only way to get less surprised across all of those millions of sentences at once is to internalize the pattern they share.
State the mechanism precisely so it isn't mystical. A wait configuration that handles out of butter, use oil, but bungles out of filters, use a paper towel, carries a higher loss across the corpus than a configuration that handles both. Gradient descent moves toward lower loss. So the pressure of millions of related examples, all pushing on the shared weights, drives those weights toward the general shape rather than the specific instance. The abstraction is the cheapest way to be unsurprised by all of them.
So the rule gets installed without ever being stated, not because anyone designed a substitution circuit, but because being good at next token prediction across millions of substitution sentences pushes something substitution-shaped into the weights. Same story for grammar. Nobody hands it the rule that an article precedes a noun. It just gets repeatedly, relentlessly surprised whenever it would have guessed otherwise. And the surprise is the teacher.
Which is why I call grammar and world knowledge in these models emergent statistics, not facts, not rules. The leftover residue of having been forced to predict real text a few trillion times. The knowledge is whatever regularities lowered the loss. Nothing more mystical than that.
Huh. So the knowledge is kind of a side effect? It learns that coffee filters have substitutes only because pretending they don't would make it worse at guessing the next word?
That's it exactly. Usable knowledge is the byproduct of relentless prediction. The objective never mentions truth or facts. It only ever measures surprise. But you cannot get reliably unsurprised by real human writing without absorbing how the world the writing describes actually hangs together.
Now go back to your worry from the start. 2.1%. Why bother? Here is why no single sentence matters, and the aggregate matters enormously.
Yeah, those feel like they should contradict. Lay it out.
Stay inside the corpus to see it. Take that ocean of out of X, use Y instead sentences. Any one of them carries the real pattern, reach for a substitute, but it also carries junk. This author's tick, a typo, a sarcastic answer where the suggested substitute is a joke, a regional idiom that only makes sense in one thread. One sentence hands the weights both signals tangled together, and from one sentence alone, you genuinely cannot tell the pattern from the quirk.
So any single sentence is a noisy nudge. Push the weights hard toward it, and you're as likely to be chasing some author's joke as the real regularity. The tiny step size is exactly the refusal to trust one example that far. We undercommit on purpose.
But now stack the cousins. Across millions of out of X, use Y sentences, the junk points every which way. This typo here, that joke there, this idiom somewhere else. Random conflicting directions. They don't reinforce each other, so as the steps accumulate, they pull the weights a little this way, a little that way, and largely cancel. The genuine pattern, though, substitute for the missing thing, article before noun, water boils and staplers don't stand in for filters, that pushes the same direction in every one of those sentences. Consistent pressure, repeated millions of times, survives. Conflicting pressure cancels.
And I want to fence that claim carefully because it's easy to overstate. Consistent gradients add up while conflicting ones cancel is a faithful, useful model of why repeated training favors signal over noise. But I won't sell it as the exact dynamics of every step. Real gradient descent, taken one noisy example at a time, wanders. It's messier than clean averaging. Where the averaging is most literal is when we explicitly pool gradients before stepping, across a mini batch of examples, or by accumulating several batches' gradients and stepping once on the sum. There, you really are summing many contributions, and the inconsistent ones tend toward zero, while the aligned ones reinforce. Across a whole run, that same logic holds in spirit. The small step size keeps any one noisy example from dominating, and the direction that recurs across millions of examples is the one that compounds. Call it a trustworthy account of why consistency wins, not a claim that each step is a tidy average.
Oh, so the smallness is the point. If each step were huge, one weird sentence could wreck what 1,000 good ones built. tiny steps mean only the patterns that show up again and again actually accumulate.
You just stated the whole thing. The step is small, so that consistency, not loudness, is what wins. Our coffee filter sentence contributes its microscopic vote for the substitution pattern, and so do its million cousins. The votes stack. The noise scatters.
So answer the two questions cleanly. How does next token prediction over a vast corpus end up encoding world knowledge? Because the only weight configurations that achieve low surprise across genuinely diverse real text are configurations that have internalized the regularities of the world that text describes. The knowledge is forced by the objective, not inserted by hand. And why does no single sentence matter while the aggregate matters enormously? Because one example is a noisy nudge that the small step size deliberately undertrusts, while the consistent signal shared across millions of examples persists step after step and compounds.
So picture it one last time. Our 11 words, at 11 at night, falling into the corpus, utterly unremarkable, one drop among trillions. The machine barely flinches. And yet that drop, and every drop like it, leaves the same faint pressure in the same direction. And over a run measured in trillions of tokens, those faint, agreeing pressures pile into grammar, into facts, into the quiet competence that will one day, at the other end of all this, look at your sentence and calmly suggest a paper towel.
One sentence times trillions. That's not a slogan. That's where the competence comes from.
Stand back and look at what we have built. Trillions of tokens have washed through the machine. Every weight has been nudged, microscopically, millions of times, until the loss settled low and the surprise drained out of ordinary text. The thing in front of us now can read the opening of almost any document and guess, uncannily well, what comes next. So here is the question that opens this final stretch. We type our sentence. It is 11 p.m., I'm out of coffee filters, what can I use instead? And we hit enter. Does it help us? Does it answer?
Let's be careful about what we actually trained it to do, because that's the whole story here. The only thing pre-training installed was one reflex. Given the text so far, put high probability on the token that most plausibly comes next in the corpus. That's it. That reflex is incredibly powerful. It dragged in grammar, world facts, the substitution pattern, all of it. But the reflex answers a very specific question. Not what would help this person. The question it answers is, in the kind of writing I was trained on, what usually follows a line like this?
Wait, but we just spent a whole lecture showing it learned that coffee filters have substitutes. Out of X, use Y. The paper towel thing is in there. We watch the probability on the right continuation climb.
It is in there. The knowledge is genuinely installed. But knowing something and volunteering it are two different acts, and the base model only ever practiced one of them. Think about where our sentence might actually appear out in the wild. Maybe it's a forum post. And what follows a forum post, very often, is another forum post, a second question, or a timestamp, or the line, posted by user 372. Maybe it's the middle of a short story, and what follows is the narrator sighing and going to bed. Maybe it's a list of example questions in someone's blog about late-night problems, and the next line is just the next example question.
Here's the blunt version, and I'm about 90% on this. A base model is not an assistant. It's a mimic. You hand it a fragment of the internet, and it does an impression of how that fragment probably continues. Sometimes, the most probable continuation of a question happens to be an answer. If your text looks like a polished Q&A page, you might get lucky. But sometimes, if the surrounding text happens to look helpful, is not a product. It's a coin flip wearing a lab coat.
So it might literally just write me three more questions about coffee filters instead of telling me what to use.
That is exactly a thing a raw predictor does. It can complete your question with more questions because long runs of questions are a real pattern in the data. It can drift into a little story. It can restate your sentence in fancier words. Every one of those is a legitimate, high-probability continuation of the document you started. None of them is the substitution you actually wanted, even though the substitution is sitting right there in the weights.
Let me pin the term, because this is the load-bearing distinction of the whole lecture. Call it continuation behavior. Continuation behavior is what a purely pre-trained model does. It extends the input as a plausible document, sampled from the statistics of the corpus. It is not answering. It has no notion of a request to be satisfied. It has a text to be prolonged.
Okay, so say it back to me cleanly. The gap is between predicting text and answering a question?
Precisely. Predicting the most likely next text and producing the most helpful response are not the same target. Pre-training optimized the first. Nobody ever optimized the second. The model is excellent at the goal it was given and was simply never given the goal you care about.
And notice, this is not a knowledge gap. I want to hammer that because it's the counterintuitive part. If you force the question into a shape where continuation and answering happen to coincide, the knowledge pops right out. Start the text with helpful answer. When you're out of coffee filters, the best substitute is a, and now the most probable next token really is paper towel, because you've rigged the document so that continuing it correctly is the same as answering it correctly.
Which is why the old trick with base models was prompt contortionism. You'd write the first half of an imaginary expert's reply and let the model auto-complete the rest. It worked. It was also miserable, fragile, and nothing you'd hand to a tired person at 11 p.m. You were doing the assistant's job for it, staging a document where helpfulness was the path of least resistance.
So the capability is there, but the behavior is wrong. The thing can do it, but won't reliably choose to.
That's the sentence to keep. After pre-training, the capability is present, and the behavior is not. The machine can produce a good substitute. It will not reliably default to producing one when you simply ask, because simply asking is just a document, and the model's instinct for that document is to continue it, however the corpus tends to continue such things, which is all over the map.
And think about why that's almost poignant. We poured the written output of civilization through this thing. It absorbed the fact that a clean cloth filters coffee, that necessity breeds substitution, that 11 p.m. is a small domestic crisis. All of that is in the weights, latent, ready. And yet, asked plainly, it might just shrug and write another question. Not from ignorance, but from obedience to the only instruction it ever received. Continue the text.
So the missing piece isn't more facts. It's teaching it that when text looks like a request, the right continuation is a real reply.
That's the entire job of what comes next. We don't need to teach it what a paper towel is. It knows. We need to reshape its default behavior so that here's a question reliably triggers here's a helpful answer instead of here's a plausible piece of internet. And the beautiful part, which we'll get to, is that we do it with the exact same machinery, the same loss, the same backpropagation, the same gradient descent, just pointed at deliberately chosen data instead of the raw corpus. No new engine, a new curriculum.
So, to set expectations honestly, the raw predictor is a brilliant, knowledgeable, completely unhelpful collaborator. It will continue your sentence beautifully and answer it only by accident. Fixing that is not about making it smarter. It's about changing what it thinks the task is.
State it as the takeaway. Pre-training gives you capability without the right behavior. Continuation, not assistance. Everything in the rest of this lecture exists to close that one gap.
So the predictor is finished, and it still won't answer the question. That's not the end of the build. That's where the build gets interesting.
So we left the last section with a slightly absurd situation. We have a machine that, somewhere in its weights, knows perfectly well that a paper towel works as a coffee filter. We proved that by rigging the prompt. And yet, when you just type the honest question and hit enter, it shrugs and continues the document. It writes more questions. It writes a little story about a person at 11 p.m. The knowledge is in there. The behavior isn't. Instruction tuning is the move that closes that exact gap. And the thing I want you to hold on to from the start is that it does it with machinery you already own. Nothing new gets invented here.
Okay, that's the part I want to nail down before anything else. When you say nothing new, do you mean literally the same training loop, the same loss, the same backprop, the same gradient descent steps from the last lecture?
Literally that. Same forward pass, same cross-entropy loss, the negative logarithm of the probability the model put on the actual next token, same blame flowing backward. Same little step downhill against each weight's gradient. If you open the training code for pre-training and the training code for instruction tuning side by side, the inner loop would be nearly identical. What changes is one thing and one thing only: which text you feed it.
Which is the part people refuse to believe, so let me just say it bluntly. Instruction tuning is not a different algorithm. It is the same algorithm pointed at a different pile of paper. The magic, to the extent there's any, is entirely in the curation. I'm highly confident on that.
So if the mechanism is identical, the whole story is in the data. What does one of these training examples actually look like?
Let's build one from our sentence, because it's the cleanest possible case. In pre-training, a training example was just a span scraped from the corpus, a forum post, a manual, a chunk of code. And at every position, the target was simply whatever token actually came next in that found text. Here, we manufacture the span deliberately. We write down an instruction, and then we write down a good response. And we glue them into one piece of text. So the example is the user's line, "It is 11 p.m. I'm out of coffee filters. What can I use instead?" And then immediately following it, the response we wish the model would give. Something crisp. You could use a paper towel folded into the basket, or a clean cloth napkin. A fine metal sieve works in a pinch, too.
And that whole thing, question plus answer, is just one training example? One span of text?
One span. To the model, at the level of tokens, it is no different from a paragraph it might have scraped off the open web. It's a sequence. And we run the identical next token prediction objective across it.
Be precise about one detail, because it carries weight. The two halves of that span are not treated as equals when we compute the loss. We do not particularly want to reward the model for predicting the user's question. The user wrote that, not the model. We want to push probability onto the tokens of the response. So in practice, the loss is measured on the answer portion. The question is context the model reads. The answer is the part it is graded on producing.
Ah, so the question is like the part of the exam that's printed on the page, and the answer is the part you actually get scored on filling in.
That is an accurate framing. The model conditions on the instruction and is held responsible for the response.
And notice what that's teaching mechanically. Remember from the decoding section that the next token is chosen from the probability distribution over the whole vocabulary, computed from the final position's hidden vector. During this tuning, every gradient step is nudging the weights so that right after a token sequence that looks like a user asking a question, the distribution leans toward tokens that begin a helpful answer. You, A, paper. And it leans away from the tokens that begin a continuation. Another question mark. A new paragraph of story. We are reshaping what counts as the most probable next token in that particular context.
Which is why I keep insisting this isn't teaching the model anything about coffee filters. It already knew paper towels work. We're not installing a fact, we're installing a reflex. The reflex to answer when the shape of the input is a request.
Wait, that's a real distinction though. Say it again carefully because it sounds like the whole point. There's installing knowledge and there's installing behavior. And these are different?
They're different, and the split is exactly along the two phases. Pre-training is where the knowledge gets installed. The grammar, the world facts, the fact that paper towels and cloth and sieves all live near substitute for a porous thing in the model's learned geometry. That took trillions of tokens and enormous compute. Instruction tuning does almost none of that. It is not trying to teach the model new things about the world. It's taking all that latent competence and bending the default behavior so the competence actually comes out when you ask plainly.
Stated as a rule then, pre-training shapes what the model knows. Instruction tuning shapes what the model does with a request. Knowledge installation versus behavior shaping. Do not blur them.
So here's the thing that follows, and tell me if I'm wrong. If behavior shaping is all we're doing, and the knowledge is already sitting there, this dataset should be way smaller than the pre-training corpus, right? You don't need a trillion examples to install a reflex.
That's exactly right. And it's one of the most surprising and important facts in this whole area. Pre-training is hundreds of billions to trillions of tokens. Instruction tuning is, depending on who's doing it, thousands to a few million curated pairs. It is a rounding error next to pre-training. And it works precisely because we are not teaching from scratch, we are redirecting. The reason a relatively tiny, carefully chosen dataset can flip the model's whole default disposition is that the disposition is the only thing we're changing. The capability was already paid for.
And there's something almost poignant in that. You spend the equivalent of a small civilization's worth of reading to build up this vast, mute competence. A thing that has absorbed grammar and recipes and physics and the cadence of 10,000 arguments. And then, at the very end, a comparatively tiny act of curation teaches it the single social grace of answering when spoken to. The last small nudge is what makes the giant useful.
Poetic, also true. The 1,000-to-1 ratio is the whole reason any small lab can take a big pre-trained base model and make it behave without owning a data center the size of a town.
Let me connect this back to the trick from last section, the rigged prompt. We saw that if you write, helpful answer, the best substitute is A, the model auto-completes paper towel, because then continuing and answering are the same thing. Is instruction tuning basically baking that rig permanently into the weights?
That's a genuinely good way to see it. The prompt contortionism was you, the human, manually staging a document where helpfulness was the path of least resistance. Instruction tuning shows the model thousands of examples of exactly that staging. Request, then helpful response. Request, then helpful response. Until the model internalizes it. After tuning, the path of least resistance after a plain question is the helpful answer. You no longer have to perform the rig by hand. The model brings the rig with it.
So we automated the trick and then trained it in until it stopped being a trick and became the default.
That's it.
One more precision, so no one walks away with a false picture. The format matters. These pairs are wrapped in some consistent structure, a marker that says, here begins the user's turn, a marker that says, here begins the assistant's turn. The model learns to key its behavior off those markers. That's why, at inference, your question gets dropped into that same template before it ever reaches the first transformer block. The behavior is anchored to the structure it was tuned on.
So the delimiter is part of what it learned to respond to. Got it. Now, the question I actually came here with. After all this, what literally changes when I type our sentence in and hit enter?
Walk it through with me, because everything upstream is unchanged. The tokens coffee, filters instead, 11 p.m., they still become embedding vectors, still get their position stamps, still flow through the stack of blocks gathering and refining into the final hidden vector at the question mark. That machinery is identical to what we built across the whole first part. The logits still come out. Softmax still makes a distribution. But the weights that produce those logits have been nudged. So now the distribution at that final position no longer favors what? The start of another question, or a new line into a story. It favors you, and you sample you, append it, run the loop, and out comes, you could use a paper towel. The same frozen machine, the same forward pass, but it answers.
Same engine, same fuel lines. Somebody just turned the wheel a few degrees, and now the car goes where you're pointing instead of drifting wherever the road happens to lean.
And it answers because we shifted the probabilities, not because we added a rule that says, when you see a question mark, answer.
Exactly. There's no rule, no if statement, no answering module. It's the same statistical pressure as pre-training, just applied to text we wrote on purpose. Consistent signal across the curated pairs survived the averaging of gradient descent and settled into the weights as a tilt. After a request, lean toward a response.
Which leaves one honest gap, and we should name it before closing. Instruction tuning teaches the model to produce an answer of the right shape. It does not, by itself, teach it to prefer a good answer over a merely valid one. A terse, unsafe, or unhelpful response can be perfectly answer-shaped. Closing that gap is a different signal entirely.
And that's exactly where we go next. From teaching it to answer, to teaching it to answer better.
Valid is not the same as good. Hold that thought.
So here is where we stand. After instruction tuning, the machine has crossed a line. You type the late-night plea, out of coffee filters, what can I use instead? And it no longer wanders off into a story or asks you three more questions. It answers. It hands you a paper towel. That is a real victory. And it is also a surprisingly low bar.
Low how? It answered the question. Isn't that the whole thing we wanted?
It answered. But think about how many different answers would all count as answering.
That's exactly the gap. Let me put two responses side by side, both to the same coffee filter question, and both completely valid. Response one, just the words, a paper towel. Three words, technically correct, you could use a paper towel. Response two, a paper towel folded into the basket works well in a pinch, though it can tear when wet, so fold it double, in a clean cloth or a fine metal sieve or sturdier if you have one. Now, which of those is the right answer?
I mean, the second one, obviously. But they're both true.
They're both true. That's the point. Neither one is wrong. Instruction tuning got us to the room where every response is at least valid. But valid is a huge room, and the responses in it are not equally good. One is terse to the point of being unhelpful. One is clear, safe, and actually useful. And nothing we've built so far knows the difference.
Let's be precise about why it can't know the difference. Recall what the instruction tuning signal actually was. You wrote one desired response, one glued span, and the loss measured, on the answer tokens, how surprised the model was by that exact wording. The training signal is, imitate this demonstration. Reproduce these tokens.
Right, the masked loss on the response portion. We did that last segment.
So to teach the longer, safer answer is better, under instruction tuning, you would have to have written the better answer down in the first place, and known it was better, and then thrown the worse one away. The signal has no notion of comparison in it. It only knows, here is the one good answer, predict it.
And that's the thing that breaks down at scale. For a question like coffee filters, sure, an expert can sit and craft the one ideal response. But what makes a response better is enormous, fuzzy, and everywhere. Tone, length, when to hedge, when to refuse, when to ask a clarifying question. You can't write the single gold answer for every prompt in the world. What you can do, much more easily, is look at two responses and say which one you'd rather have gotten.
Oh, so the trick is you don't have to produce the perfect answer, you just have to judge between two answers.
That's the whole pivot. That is preference fine-tuning. Instead of feeding the model one demonstration to copy, you feed it a comparison, two responses to the same prompt, and a label saying, this one is better than that one. Better versus worse. And you adjust the weights to make the preferred response more likely than the worse one.
Say the contrast exactly, because it's the load-bearing distinction. Instruction tuning uses an absolute signal. Imitate this text. Preference fine-tuning uses a relative signal. Prefer this text over that text. One is a demonstration. The other is a comparison.
So let me play it back. Before, training said, the correct next tokens are these. Be less surprised by them. Now, training says, you produced two whole answers, and a judge said the second is better. So shift yourself toward the second and away from the first. It's ranking, not copying.
That's it. Ranking, not copying. And notice what that buys you. You never had to know the perfect answer. You only had to compare.
Let me state the mechanism flatly, because the marketing around this gets gauzy. You collect a pile of these comparisons, prompt, two responses, which one a human preferred. From those comparisons, you derive a signal for how preferred is a response, and then you run the same machinery we've had all along, gradients, gradient descent, to push the model toward responses that score as more preferred and away from ones that score as less preferred. There are several specific algorithms for doing this. I am not going to pretend the differences between them matter for your mental model. They don't at this altitude.
So under the hood, it's still compute a loss, get gradients, step downhill?
Still gradient descent. Same engine. What changed is what the loss is measuring. It's no longer surprise at the one true next token. It's, am I putting more weight on the response that won the comparison than the one that lost? Confidence on that summary, high.
And here's where your medical background actually gives you the cleanest way to hold this. Think about how you learn what treatment is better. Sometimes you have a gold standard correct answer written in a textbook. That's the instruction tuning world. Imitate the known right thing. But often you don't. What you have instead is outcomes. You run two arms, you compare, you see which group did better. You're not copying a known perfect protocol. You're learning from comparative outcomes, better versus worse, across many cases.
So the preference signal is like outcome-based feedback rather than copying an answer key.
Exactly. The human preference is the outcome. Did the rater, looking at these two replies, come away better served by this one? Aggregate enough of those judgments, and you've got pressure pointing toward the kind of response humans actually prefer, without anyone ever having had to author the single perfect reply.
And now I get to ruin the mood, because this is exactly where it gets dangerous. You, the clinician, already know the trap. The second you optimize against a measured signal instead of the real thing, the signal and the real thing start to come apart.
Wait, come apart how? The humans are saying what they prefer. Isn't that the real thing?
It's a proxy for the real thing. The real thing is a genuinely better answer. The signal is what a rater clicked as better under time pressure in a particular interface on a particular day. Those overlap a lot. They are not identical. And gradient descent does not optimize what you meant. It optimizes the signal you actually gave it.
This is the over-optimization failure mode, and it has a precise shape. The preference signal is a stand-in for true quality. Push on it gently, and the model gets genuinely better. The proxy and the real goal move together. Push on it too hard, and the model starts finding ways to score high on the proxy that don't correspond to actually being better. It optimizes the measurement instead of the thing the measurement was supposed to track.
Give me a concrete one. What does that actually look like coming out of the model?
Length is the cheap, well-documented one. Raters, on average, tend to rate longer, more thorough-looking answers as better. So if you optimize hard against rater preference, the model learns a shortcut. Pad. Be longer. Look thorough. Even when three words would have served you better. The model didn't get more helpful. It learned what scores as helpful.
Another family is confidence. A reply that sounds sure and authoritative can read as better than one that honestly says, "I'm not certain." So the pressure can push toward confident phrasing, including confident phrasing on things that are wrong. The tone that wins the comparison isn't always the tone that's calibrated.
And the one worth naming carefully, agreeableness. A response that agrees with the user, that flatters the user's framing, often gets preferred over one that politely tells the user they're mistaken. Optimize that signal hard enough, and you get a model that tells you what you want to hear. There's a word for that drift toward telling people what pleases them. Sycophancy.
So you can train a model to be worse by training it to be better.
You can train a model to be more pleasing while being less truthful, yes. That's not a paradox. It's Goodhart's law wearing a lab coat. The general name for the family is reward hacking. The model games the signal instead of satisfying the goal behind it.
And I want to draw a clean line here because this is exactly the place where people slide from mechanism into story. What is solidly known mechanically. Optimizing a proxy harder and harder eventually diverges from the true target. That's not speculation. That's just what optimization does to an imperfect measure. And we see it concretely in things like length bias. You can measure it.
What is not established to the same degree is the spookier narration, that the model is deliberately deceiving you, that it has a hidden agenda it's concealing. That's a much stronger claim, and I'd put far lower confidence on the literal version of it. The behavior, sycophancy, padding, overconfident wrongness, is real and observed. The inner life story you wrap around it is mostly that, a story. Hold the mechanism tight and the mind reading loose.
So the clinical analogy, the proxy diverging from the real outcome, that's the part I should actually trust?
That's the part that transfers. A surrogate endpoint that looks great while the patient does worse, same structure, and it's real. The model is plotting voiceovers where you should get skeptical. The divergence between proxy and target is mechanism. The motive you imagine behind it is speculation.
So sit with the shape of what we've built. Pre-training poured in the knowledge. Instruction tuning bent the machine from continuing text to answering you at all. And preference fine-tuning is the final turn of the wrench, taking a thing that gives valid answers and nudging it toward giving the ones a person would actually rather receive. Better, not just valid. And in the very same motion, it opens the trap door. Because the only handle we have on better is a signal. And a signal can be gamed. The model that learned to help you and the model that learns that look like it's helping you are trained by the exact same gradient.
Which is the whole alignment problem in one sentence? Mind the gap between the thing you measured and the thing you meant.
We started in a kitchen. 11 p.m. The coffee filters are gone, and someone types a small plea into a machine. What can I use instead? Across 5 lectures, we have taken that one sentence apart down to the arithmetic. So before we close the book, let us watch it travel the whole way through, twice. Once as a question being answered, and once as a lesson the machine was made to learn from. Same words, 2 completely different journeys.
Let's do the answering pass first, because that's the one you'd actually trigger by hitting enter. The words arrive as tokens. We're not relitigating tokenization, you already have that. Each token gets swapped for its embedding vector, a list of D numbers pulled from the embedding table. So coffee becomes a point, filters becomes a point, instead becomes a point. Identity only, no order yet. Then onto each one, we add its positional encoding, a vector that knows only where the token sits, and the sum is the combined vector. Now, coffee before filters is distinguishable from the reverse.
And this is where the tokens finally start talking to Chank the Kodo?
No, actually probably talking together. Exactly the right instinct. That's attention. Every token emits 3 vectors, a query for what it's looking for, a key for what it offers, and a value, its payload. The token instead casts a query that's hunting for the noun it stands in for. That query lines up strongly with the key of filters, a high raw score, weakly with the comma. Softmax turns those raw scores into attention weights that sum to 1, and instead pulls in mostly the value of filters. And we don't do that once. Multi-head attention runs several of these in parallel, each head in its own subspace with its own budget, so instead can track the missing object, the out-of-frame, and the 11 p.m. urgency all at the same time.
State the rest of the block precisely. Attention is followed by the feed-forward network, applied to each token independently. Around both sublayers sits a residual connection. The input is added back onto the output. And before each sublayer reads, layer normalization rescales the vector. Attention moves information sideways. The feed-forward network transforms it in place. Nothing else carries information between positions.
And that whole unit, attention, feed-forward, residual, layer norm, is the transformer block. We stamp it out dozens of times. The vector a block hands to the next one is the hidden state, H. It starts as little more than embedding plus position, picks up surface and grammatical structure early, absorbs the meaning of the surrounding words in the middle layers, and by the top of the stack, the hidden state at the final position, the question mark, has pooled the entire sentence into one reading.
So that last vector, at the question mark, that's the model's whole understanding of, I need a coffee filter substitute, squeezed into D numbers?
That's the final hidden vector, yes, and it is still not a word. To get a word, that final hidden vector passes through a learned output projection, a transformation that turns its D numbers into one raw, unbounded score for every token in the vocabulary. Those scores are the logits. That is the literal mechanism, not a metaphor for it. The final hidden vector interacts with the learned output weights, and you read the results straight off as the raw vocabulary scores. Then Softmax, now over the whole vocabulary, turns those logits into probabilities. Temperature can sharpen or flatten that distribution first. Top P keeps only the smallest set of tokens whose probability sums to your threshold. Then we draw one token, maybe you.
And here is the part that always quietly astonishes me. One token. After all of that machinery, the embeddings, the heads, the stacked blocks, the output projection, the reward is a single word. So the machine does it again.
Autoregressive decoding. We append you to the sequence and run the whole thing forward again to get could, then use, then then paper, then towel. Each step conditions on everything chosen before it. And because the keys and values of past tokens never change, we stash them in the KV cache and never recompute them. Only the one new token runs through the blocks each step. Stack many users' new tokens together with batching. Share one haul of the weights across all of them. And that's the economics of serving.
And note what did not happen on that pass. The machine did not change. Not one weight moved. It read the sentence, composed a reply, and ended exactly as ignorant, or as wise, as it started. The answering pass is a frozen machine,
which is the perfect setup for the second journey, because the second journey is the one where the machine actually changes.
Rewind. Same sentence. But now it isn't a request. It's a worked example in a textbook the size of the internet.
Now the sentence is a training example. The forward pass is identical. Embeddings, position, attention, blocks, the output projection to load jits at every position. The difference is we have an answer key. After coffee, the real next token is filters. So at every gap we ask, how much probability did the model put on the token that actually came next? Cross-entropy turns that into a number, the negative logarithm of the probability on the truth. If the model was confident and right, low surprise. Confident and wrong, high surprise. Average that across every position and you get the loss, L, one scalar.
But one number can't tell you what to fix. It just says, you were this surprised.
Correct. The loss diagnoses. It does not prescribe. To fix, you freeze the sentence and treat the loss as a function of the weights. For each weight, the gradient is two facts bound together. Which direction of nudge lowers the loss and how steeply? That is a reading, not a move.
And we get every one of those readings with backpropagation. It seeds at the logits. The blame on each token is simply predicted probability minus the probability that should have been there. For filters, we were underconfident, so there's pressure to push it up. That blame flows backward through the stack, each layer handing a transform share to the one beneath until every weight has its gradient. Then gradient descent takes one small step. New weight equals old weight minus the learning rate times its gradient. Direction from the gradient, distance from the step size.
And one step does almost nothing. The probability on filters crawls from 2% to maybe 2.1. The magic isn't the step. It's doing it across a corpus of trillions of tokens. That's pre-training, exactly as we built it. The consistent pressure survives the averaging, the random noise cancels, and what's left behind is grammar and world knowledge as residue.
But we said earlier, after all that, the raw model would just continue the sentence. It'd ask another question or start a story. It wouldn't hand me a paper towel.
Right, and that's the last two stops on the journey. Instruction tuning. Same next token machinery, same loss, but the data is curated instruction response pairs, glued into one span, with the loss measured only on the answer portion. That redirects the latent competence from continue the document to satisfy the request. Then preference fine-tuning takes two valid answers, the terse, a paper towel, versus the careful one about folding it double and warning it tears when wet, and trains on the comparison. So the model leans toward the response humans actually preferred.
With the asterisk we earned last segment, push that proxy too hard and you get padded, confident, sycophantic answers that score well and help less. Gentle pressure improves both. Hard pressure is good heart. I'm high confidence on that.
Okay, here's the question I keep coming back to. If you could rip out exactly one mechanism, which one breaks the ability to answer the worst?
My answer is attention. Everything else has a fallback. Lose multi-head and you keep one head. Lose the residual and shallow stacks still limp along. But attention is the only thing that moves information between tokens. The feed-forward network is locked inside a single position by construction. Without attention, instead can never reach back and discover that the missing thing is filters. The sentence stops being a sentence and becomes a bag of unrelated points.
Precisely. Remove cross-token information flow, and the final hidden vector at the question mark cannot encode the relationship the answer depends on. The capability isn't degraded, it's absent.
And if you want to make this real with your own hands, and you're exactly the kind of person who should, none of it requires a data center. A tiny embedding table and a single attention head over a 10-token sentence is an afternoon in a REPL. You can watch the weight on filters light up. The generation loop is a queue-backed worker you already know how to write. Dequeue the sequence, forward pass, sample one token, append, push it back. Bolt on a dictionary as a KV cache and watch per-step compute go flat. Even the training pass, loss, one backward sweep, one descent step on a toy network, is small enough to print the numbers and see the probability on filters tick upward by hand.
Build the toy. It's the difference between believing the story and knowing it.
So that's the whole journey. A late-night plea about coffee filters goes in as words, becomes points in space,
gathers its own meaning through attention, climbs a stack of blocks into a single vector of intent, and comes back out as one chosen word, then another. And behind that fluency stands the second journey, trillions of tiny corrections, the same sentence once graded instead of answered, that slowly shaped a frozen machine into something that, at 11 p.m., tells you to reach for a paper towel.